Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. As Thanksgiving grows near, we have an awful lot to be thankful for. But we're going to be talking about homelessness in America. What's it mean for folks who are struggling to make ends meet? And what have we done to help them? We're going to talk about that. Also, on the education front, as you look around the country, this push towards profitization and privatization, has Teach for America, has it done what it was supposed to do? Has it done what we were sold that it would do? We'll find out about that. Also, more on Obamacare as the December 1st deadline grows nearer. The hope is that they get the bugs all worked out and that people start getting the health care that they so rightly need. And the thing that gets me is, you know, you get these Republicans who have been against it from the beginning, have been fighting tooth and nail to block and obstruct and destroy and delay and all of that, and saying, hey, now we need to fix it by repealing it and giving you pay or die. To me, at the end of all of this, this whole charade, this whole situation is privatization. The whole public-private partnership that I tell you doesn't work, this is what it was. When 55 for-profit corporations have their fingers in something, trust me, ain't working. Ain't working at all, and no surprise. Also going to talk about fun with guns, lots of fun gun stories here in the last couple of days. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever is on your mind tonight. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So we hear a lot, and I'm waiting. I've already heard the voices screaming that there's a war on Christmas because they're not going to say Merry Christmas. They're going to say Happy Holidays. I was explaining that to my 11-year-old today, and she's like, that's dumb, Dad. I go, I know, it's dumb. But these are what the right-wing pundits are throwing out to us as red meat. And my question back is, where is Sarah Palin? Where is Bill O'Reilly in the war on Thanksgiving? Because there really is a war on Thanksgiving. I mean, honestly, I mean, the Christmas decorations and the stores were already decorating for Christmas back before Halloween. Thanksgiving's been an afterthought. In fact, it's been kind of a nuisance because, hey, we got to get to Black Friday. So we're kind of, there's a massive secret war on Thanksgiving. And for me, you know, Thanksgiving is one of those holidays that I think is extremely important. As someone like me who believes in family values, and I do, I believe wholeheartedly in the unit of the family, define it however you have to. But I believe in the family structure. I believe that people should have time together so that their relationships can strengthen and grow and, you know, stay solid. I firmly believe families need time together. And as a kid growing up, I remember, and I know, you know, for people younger than me, and look, I'm only 46, there was a time in this country where not everything was open on Sundays. There was a time when Sundays was a family day. You did your church thing, whatever that was, you did your whatever, and you spent the day with your family. I know, I you can't even imagine it today, can you? A whole day with them? And that's what it's turned into. The more time you spend apart, the more you get used to not being together, and the more I think you see a tearing of the family apart. So my right-wing friends, my Christian theocrats, my chest-thumping libertarians, all of my family value friends who care about, I'm pro-life and blah, blah, blah. Where are you on saving Thanksgiving? Where are you on saving the family? Because, you know, when I look at this, to me, Thanksgiving is one of the last days that the family comes together, sits down, and actually breaks bread together at a family table. There are very few days left, very few days left, where you see multi-generational family gatherings. So where are my right-wingers? Where are the we care about family? Where are they? I know they're fighting the good fight. They're fighting the battles against those people getting married. They're fighting the battles against those people who have children out of wedlock. I know they're fighting those battles, but don't you think saving the family now, don't you think that's important? And I know there's some people going, Rick, what are you talking about? I don't see the war on Thanksgiving. Well, look at all the big box retailers. Look at the employers across this country who are saying, you know what? We've got to beat the other guy to Black Friday. We've got to open our doors at 10 o'clock on Thursday night, on 9 o'clock on Thursday night, 8 o'clock. In fact, we're not going to close our doors at all. We'll be open all day Thursday. And you know what? Our workers are just going to have to thump it. Maybe have your family day some other time. Because our bottom line, our profit margin, much more important than your crummy little family unit. That's what they're saying. And yet, I don't hear the voices who are out there so loud and so boisterous on their soapboxes screaming about the bagger at the checkout counter said, Happy Holiday to me. They should have said Merry Christmas. Well, you know what? That person should be home with their family. Maybe you agree, maybe you disagree. But I don't know how anybody with any thought or proclivity towards the idea or the ideal of family values can possibly say it's a good thing to have people working on one of the last days in our society that says, you know what? We're going to have a day of family, a day of Thanksgiving, a day of being grateful for our health, being grateful for the people around us, being grateful for what we have, and for thinking about how is it that we can help others. To me, that's what Thanksgiving is about. It's not just about stuffing yourself with turkey and watching a football game, although that's what the corporatists have pushed us towards. It's about that day together. And, you know, I was watching some of the ads, and I don't watch an awful lot of television. Don't really have the time for it or really the patience for it. But I was watching some of the commercials where, and I forget the one of the stores who it was. It was one of the big box retailers or somebody who, you know, the wife was going, well, while the husband's sitting watching football, you know, we're going to go shopping. We're going to do our sport, which is shopping. And I'm going, well, you know, come on, are you kidding me? And no, they're not. Playing into every stereotype possible. I wish, and I know it's not going to happen. I know like rats to cheese. I know that as soon as they open the doors and they dangle the carrots, we are going to rush to their doors. But I wish. And if I could have that one wish just on one day where we say, you know what, as a society, I'm not going out Thanksgiving Day. We're not going to buy your trinkets. We're not going to help your bottom line. It's not going to happen. We are going to stay home. And I would love to see the doors swing wide open at the big box retailers and all you hear are crickets. Because for me, this, I think back to all of the days that I had as a kid growing up where the family did come together. And maybe it was just that one day where there was some intergenerational peace, some factions that weren't fighting, but they were a day of coming together and being close, if not just for that one day. And I think back, and I was talking about this with my daughter today, as, you know, I, growing up, did not have a lot of the things that my kids take for granted, like full cupboards. Thanksgiving, I remember mac and cheese, and I remember being grateful for that. Is it that we've changed that much as a society that we don't need that moment? It's a very interesting time, and I got to be honest. The more I'm seeing this Pope Francis, the more I have some hope, because it's easy to be in despair. It's easy to step back and go, man, it's just over our heads. There's nothing we can do about it. The wave of capitalists, the moneyed interests are pushing us so far. It's just we're never going to stem the tide. It's never going to happen. But I see this Pope who just came out with an 84-page document, something known as an apostolical exhortation, which is just basically a communication from the Pope, where he's calling on politicians and folks around the world to guarantee their citizens dignified work, education, health care. And I said, you start thinking about this. Who in their right mind would be calling for work and education and health care and shelter and clothing and food? Who in their right mind would be calling for such a thing? And they go, yeah, the Pope. Duh. He's also criticized the idolatry of money, and we've talked about this on a number of times. In fact, he begged the Lord to deliver politicians who were more concerned with profits and make them more concerned for the poor and inequality. And I go, you know what? This is what we need to be focusing on. And in his piece, he wrote, just as the commandment thou shalt not kill sets a clear limit in order to safeguard the value of human life, today we also have to say thou shalt not to an economy of exclusion and inequality. Such an economy kills. He goes on to write, as long as the problems of the poor are not radically resolved by rejecting the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation, and by attacking the structural causes of inequality, no solution will be found with the world's problems, or, for that matter, any problems. And I look at this and I go, that is a huge statement. The Pope is pushing back against this idea of the market. Because don't we hear it? Well, Walmart says the people want us open on Thanksgiving, and our workers are excited to be working Thanksgiving. And that's the argument. Well, the people want it. No. The people really don't want it. But you've dangled this carrot in front of their face. And they came. To me, as a society, and this is where I think laws have to be put in place. There used to be blue laws when I was a kid. Things were closed on Sundays for a reason, because it was basically a law. Maybe we need something like that again. Because I believe there has to be, if you are truly the family value people, there has to be, as a society, somewhere where we go, you know what? This 24/7, it's got to stop. We've got to slow things down just a bit. And if it's just for a little bit of time, once a week or once even a month at this point, I'll take anything. It's what we should be doing. Just seems right to me. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about homelessness in America. The Babes of Wrath just wrapped up their New England tour, the Frostbite tour of homeless shelters in the area, up there in the Northeast. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Airlines mechanics represented by the Teamsters held informational pickets at 10 airports around the U.S. on Monday. They may be forced to strike if the airline doesn't reinstate the workers' pension plans as promised. United's 25,000 AFA-CWA union flight attendants are standing in solidarity with the Teamster mechanics. In 2005, United took away the pensions of 11,000 aviation mechanics, but promised to restore them when the company's finances improved. Now with hundreds of millions of dollars, $1 billion in profits, United Airlines this year had the highest revenue in history in the second quarter. So what happened to the pensions promise? United broke off negotiations with the Teamster mechanics without an agreement to restore the pensions, and United also announced that 3,500 mechanics will pay between $300 and $500 a month more in health care costs. The mechanics want the flying public to know why they may be on strike. The 25,000 United Airlines flight attendants say they stand shoulder to shoulder with their Teamster brothers and sisters on the pension promise issue.
Out in the snow, there's someone out there right now that's stuck in the snow, that's calling AAA, that's waiting for help. But I just want everyone to know that the guys that's showing up a large percentage of the time, if they're coming from Club Assist, they are affected by this lawsuit.
Former roadside assistance worker Maurice Brown. Brown and other AAA contracted roadside assistance drivers have filed a class action lawsuit challenging bad working conditions and low pay, up to 18-hour workdays in all weather and earning as little as $4 an hour. As tens of millions of Americans hit the road for Thanksgiving travel, many will call on AAA for help when stranded on the road. Maurice Brown and other roadside assistance workers want AAA members to know that many roadside assistance workers make less than minimum wage, especially those who work for Club Assist. When Brown and other workers challenged their unfair working conditions and sub-minimum wage pay, Club Assist, with full knowledge of AAA, decided to call the workers independent contractors, dumping all the costs of doing business onto them. Brown and other AAA contracted road assistance drivers filed their class action lawsuit, and Club Assist fired them. The lawsuit is still pending, and today the workers are filing a Department of Labor complaint. Maurice Brown wants the motoring public to know how the workers who work for Club Assist and respond to AAA calls are being treated.
They're definitely not receiving the minimum wage. They're not receiving any benefits. They're not receiving any overtime pay. They're not receiving any of that. Club Assist devised a plan to put 100% liability and expenses on their workers while they get to make millions of dollars and avoid certain tax obligations.
Walmart has a new CEO, Doug McMillan. Our Walmart member and Walmart worker Tiffany Baroid says it's a testament to the pressure the company is feeling that they're changing CEOs. Baroid says Walmart workers are happy to see the new CEO acknowledge the hard work of Walmart workers. Baroid says our Walmart hopes that this appreciation translates into improving jobs for Walmart workers. As many as 825,000 Walmart workers earn less than $25,000 a year. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Our quote of the day from Ricardo Fuentes. He wrote in the piece, "Widening Inequality Shatters Mirage of Social Mobility." He wrote, "When we know from history that having a more equal society is not a utopian objective." And I look at this and you go, you know, we can have a more equal society. We can have a more just society. And we have in the past. And we could be working more toward that each and every day. And I look at this time of the year as a time when we need to reflect and think about, you know, be thankful and grateful for the things we have, but also how we move forward and make sure that others have opportunity as well. Our friend Pat LaMarche just finished up part of the Babes of Wrath tour. They called it the Frostbite Tour. And they went through the Northeast for a couple of days up into Maine and Massachusetts in the cold and the freezing of November to talk about homelessness. And we've got the other Bay of Wrath, not our friend Pat, but Diane Nealon. She's the founder and president of Hear Us, their website, hearus.us. We've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com. Diane, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Pat, you know, tells me just nothing but fantastic things of the work that you guys at Hear Us do. And I at this time of the year, you know, talking about homelessness and hunger issues and all of these things comes to our mind at this time of the year. It should be with us all the time. But you know, today I just had to get someone to talk about this. And this tour that you did, it was a couple of days long. Something I'm fully in behind. Can you tell me a little bit about the concept and what you did?
Well, we did a 10 day tour, about 2,000 miles, and we spoke to a number of different groups from Columbia University School of Social Work master's students to the communities in Bangor and, Portland, Bangor, Worcester, Massachusetts, probably other ones that I'm not thinking of. And then we spoke to also a group in New York City that works, they do a lot of research for homeless children. So it was a great opportunity to see a lot of different people and to share some documentary I made, My Own Four Walls, which is a powerful 20-minute piece that just has kids talking about what it's like to be homeless. And it's the one thing I will just guarantee that if anybody really needs to get their heart warmed, it will do it. So, and then Pat and I just did our little, dog and pony show, and it really was very, very satisfying.
I go back to when over the years, we've done food drives where we've lived in a parking lot of a supermarket for a week to raise food for the local food bank and money for the local shelter. And one of the moments that has just will forever be etched in my memory, it was a family that came by that they were living in their car and just wanting some help to find work more than anything. And it was the moment, my daughter at the time was, I think, 7, and they had a little girl at 7 years old, and the two of them sat and played. And for that hour, that little girl got to be, don't take this the wrong way, kind of a normal girl just playing with a friend. And
sure,
she broke into tears when they had to leave, which is one of those memories that forever etched in my mind.
Well, it's a good memory to hold on to because, sadly, there's, literally millions of kids in our country who would be in that same circumstance. They're homeless with their families. Some of them might be away from their families for any number of reasons. And there's just a growing amount of homelessness in this country, despite what HUD tells us in their recent report. But it's just a really sad thing to see the kids, totally losing out on their childhood because of this economic injustice.
And the thing that gets me is, it's, to me, it's not a good memory. It's a memory of hopelessness in my part and helplessness that there was nothing I could really do and I wanted to. I made as many calls as I could and I tried to do as much as I could. And look, as an individual, there's only so much you can do. To me, this is a societal thing. This is something that we as a society collectively should be saying. No family should, no child should go hungry, should go homeless. No family should, no person should.
I totally agree with you, and we really do have the wherewithal in this country to do that if we would get a little political will, and if we as a society would at least wake up to the fact that any of us is in jeopardy of being in this circumstance for any number of reasons, and the kinder we are to our brothers and sisters, the better our country will be and our world will be.
Now, let me ask you this, Diane, because I look at the Bush collapse of 2008 as one of those moments where a lot of families who never thought they were going to ever be in financial straits or ever asking for help found themselves in dire straits and some homeless with all the foreclosures and all the things that have gone on. My question is, I look at how hardened we've seemed to become in our politics to where now the people who are struggling are the ones who are being blamed when it's really not their fault, in my view.
Well, you're right, Rick. And I agree that there's some really hardened politics swirling around us. However, I also have to say that when you can break through that and talk to people and help them understand what's going on, a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people still have at least a shred of humanity and sometimes even more. And I've seen, partisan politics aside, you can actually end up with people understanding that this is an issue if we can just get over the hate and get beyond that and still, you know, hang on to our humanity.
Do you think that, you know, with all of the overwhelming need, because of that huge collapse in 2008, because in my view of really bad policy and deregulation, do you think that people are kind of at the point now where there's so much need, it seems overwhelming, and we're just kind of fatigued of it, and we just want it, there are some who just want it to go away, and I know walking down the streets of Harrisburg, where there are a large number of homeless people who are saying, hey, you know, can I get some help, that individuals are just kind of, you know, just kind of worn out. Do you see any of that, or I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, I think there certainly is some compassion fatigue, but there's also, I think people have sort of turned the corner in many cases and realized that, you know, if we turn our backs on our sisters and brothers that are in need in all sorts of ways, we're not doing any of us any favors. So, you know, I think we see highlighted the negative, but I think there's a lot of positive going on behind the scenes that will, you know, keep us in the human race category. And I think it's really easy to get jaundiced and to feel like we can't give any more. But I think if you can, I think focus on something local that really, you know, is doing a good job and give them your support. You know, that ripple of kindness will transform a lot. And I think we still need to do that.
Which is why I'm a big supporter of local organizations like Project Share and Carlisle Cares, who I think just do phenomenal work. And because, you know, a lot of people like to think, well, that's not in my neighbor. It's not in my backyard. That's someone else's problem. And, you know, when my daughter comes home and says, you know, I got three girls in my class whose families are homeless. You know, you go,
yeah.
It is in our backyard. It is.
Yes,
my kids,
it is.
My kids are seeing it.
It's in every area. I would certainly win the bet if I bet people that I could find homelessness in any community. Sad to say, it has spread into communities that never thought that they would be seeing people in homeless situations. And even sadder yet, we have not come up with the resources to help the families get out of homelessness. So the longer they languish in that situation, the harder it is. It's traumatic for kids, for the, you know, for the parents, for the teens that are on their own. You know, we as a nation, we're deciding it's better to be destroying other countries rather than helping, you know, people in our own country with the resources they need. And it's, you know, we're going to pay for this for generations to come.
Now, I saw a quote that's been attributed to you that I just thought was spot on and straight to the issue. You said, we must be a very wealthy nation to throw away our children.
That sounds like something I've said, yes.
And it's
true. We are throwing away. We have about 1.2 million school children in this country who have been actually identified as homeless and documented. They are, you know, they're there. It's not like we're making up these numbers. There's a lot more that we haven't counted. But that's, you know, those are kids. That doesn't include babies and toddlers. That doesn't include their parents. That doesn't include older siblings. And it doesn't include single adults that are out there. And, it, you know, so we're throwing people away and certainly children away by the millions in this country, and I don't know that people are really aware of that.
Well, I think part of it, and I guess I'll come to the defense of society, I think a good portion of it is most people are on the treadmill working their behinds off. They got their heads down. They're just trying to keep up so that they don't fall off into that situation. And maybe the blinders are just, you know, keep the head down and keep treading along so you don't fall off yourself, and maybe they don't see it. I mean, that's the best defense I can give.
Yeah, and I would agree, and I think it is tough to make a living and survive and cope with the inequities that we have, even when you have a place to live and a place to work. I think there's a lot that we could do to make this a lot better world. So it is hard. You have to, you know, pay attention. But I think it's also good to maybe look up once in a while and see that there are people out there struggling. And, you know, it might be something where, you know, if you drop off, you know, toilet paper or diapers or, you know, anything that you can afford at any of the places like Project Share or just any of the agencies in town that are helping, you know, families and adults, you'll be making a difference. And you start little and it gets bigger as you feel how good it makes you feel to give and to be a part of it.
Are shelters and food stamps, is that enough?
I'm sorry?
Are providing shelters and food stamps and soup kitchens, is that enough? I mean, there are some who go, well, you know, we've got the, you know, the missions, we've got these things. Charity will take care of it. You know, private charity will do it. We don't need government intervention. We don't need a government policy. Because we hear it all the time from our friends on the political right. Who say, well,
yes,
this shouldn't be the purview of government. It's not something government should do. We should do it through our churches and the charities. Is it possible?
No, that's absolutely, it's absolutely ludicrous to think that the churches, the faith communities can hold up the needs, you know, the people in need in this country. I mean, it's a huge, huge gap. The federal government has pulled out of housing and other assistance, you know, for the past 20 or 30 years that I've been doing this. And as they pull out, we have more people in need. Now you just have to start doing the equation. And despite absolutely tremendous effort from the faith communities, it's not enough. They're putting on Band-Aids and we're hemorrhaging. So it is definitely, you know, it is absolutely insane to think that the people can pick up where government needs to be. It's a partnership.
You know, I go back to something you just said there, that our government has walked away from housing. You know, as a kid growing up on the west side of Cleveland, I grew up in a housing project that was, you know, it was county owned. It was the Cuyahoga County Housing Municipal Housing
mm-hmm.
Authority. And, you know, you look at those investments, you know, had it not been for that housing project, as bad as it was and as violent as it was at times because of the high rates of poverty, it was still a roof over the head. And, you know, sadly, you know, we've walked away from a lot of that.
No, we it seems like we've run away from it. It's just really a sad thing to think that you can, you know, literally decimate our country's housing stock year after year and not replace it, and then think that, you know, people should be able to find private markets and they can't afford it. I was in Washington D.C. today, just in an informal briefing with Department of Education officials on homelessness. I just filmed a bunch of interviews in Texas on families that are doubled up and youth that are doubled up and have no place to stay, and they're bouncing from, you know, hither to yon. And it's just incredible that even within the Department of Education, there's just people who think, well, there's public housing, and you just go, well, yeah, there's public housing with a 10-year waiting list. So, you know, that could maybe explain why we have a backlog of people, families that are without housing. And I think it's, you know, we've just not kept up with how many cuts there have been to that type of program.
Yeah, and you know, I see this stuff. But what does it say about us as a society? We're the wealthiest country in the world. We can put people on the moon. We can cure polio. We can do so many things. Yet this doesn't seem to be a high priority.
Well, you know, and I think it's really sad that we're losing our grip on our accomplishments as we get mired in this political sewer that we seem to have jumped into, and it's. You know, we're not doing anything constructive. We're just, you know, swirling around and just taking shots at the other side. And, you know, we haven't really moved forward in the ways that we really could, given our resources and given, you know, everything that's going for us in the country, we just need to put it together in the same, you know, on the same track and get it going in the same direction. But we're not there yet.
So what are we telling people? I mean, I know you do an awful lot of speaking around the country and you do an awful lot of work. Your website, hearus.us, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Diane Nealon's name. It'll take you right there. Aside from going to the website, hearus.us, what would you want people to do? I mean, especially, you know, with this being Thanksgiving week, you know, what's the marching order? What's the action? How do we get involved? How do we start to change things?
Well, you know, you can make it simple and just look at the bounty that you have in your own home and think, you know, what can we do to share our bounty? And it could be, you know, providing some more food to the food pantries. And they're really struggling because of the food stamp cuts and SNAP cuts. So you're certainly providing food, but, you know, other things like, you know, people don't realize that if you're on food stamps, you can't buy personal hygiene items. So, you know, you could do things like, you know, drop off some toilet paper and rolls and paper towel and, you know, dish soap and that type of thing, shampoo that, you know, that every household needs. If you, you know, just, when you're going shopping, you throw a few more items as you can afford into the cart and get them over to the local, you know, pantry or, you know, shelter because they certainly need that. And, it's a good way to get kids involved and maybe kids can do, you know, their own special collections of those type of things. You know, it just really can, generate some compassion.
It's all about, in my view, it's all about being part of your community.
Yes, yes. If we were all part of our communities, we'd have that ownership that would really make us, you know, take a stand and not allow this kind of dehumanizing suffering to be, you know, going on.
I'm hoping for the best, and as I always do, I'm always grateful for what we have in our lives and always looking to how we can expand things. Diane Nealon, I appreciate you taking time for us and appreciate the work that you do. Hearus.us, the website, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Diane's name. She's the founder and president of Hearus. Diane, thanks so much.
Well, Rick, thanks for having me.
Great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We started down the trail of the early history of the establishment of our great American holiday of Thanksgiving. George Washington had established a Thanksgiving Day by presidential proclamation, but his successors left it alone and it became a celebration mostly in New England. Then a crusader named Sarah Hale arose from the citizenry to start an effort to have a national day of Thanksgiving established. She worked hard for the most part of three decades, glorifying pumpkin pie, roasted turkey, and savory stuffing. She wrote of the wonderful season of late November year after year and continually asked for a national legal holiday. Finally, her efforts paid off when President Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday in November a national holiday of Thanksgiving. Many kudos to Ms. Hale for her efforts, but Thanksgiving was soon to take another turn, one of several before becoming an established, unified national holiday in 1956. Join me next time to follow the twists and turns of our Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says Walmart is not big-hearted? Just look at the chain's outlet in Canton, Ohio, where management has set up bins for food donations, asking people to give generously to the poor, who otherwise will not have a Thanksgiving dinner. But the bins are not for customers. They're tucked back in the employees-only area. Walmart's Thanksgiving food drive is for its own employees, beseeching low-wage workers to donate to even lower-wage workers who can't afford a family dinner on this National Day of Thanks. Yes, this corporate colossus with an annual income greater than 140 countries wants its poorly paid employees to buy food for fellow employees whose paychecks leave them in deep poverty. More astonishing is the corporation's insipid, self-congratulatory insistence that the employee food drive demonstrates its deep ethical commitment to the welfare of all Walmart associates, as it grandiosely calls its beleaguered workers. The spokesman for the giant asserted that, quote, "This is part of the company's culture, to rally around associates and take care of them." But, of course, the company is not taking care of them at all. It won't pay a living wage, won't provide decent health care or other needed benefits, won't allow workers to organize so they can have their own voice. And then it abandons them to beg for scraps if they want to share in Thanksgiving with other Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is obscene, a moral outrage. Three Waltons, Alice, Robson, and Jim, are heirs to the Walmart fortune and are sitting on more than $33 billion apiece, profiting on the low wages the corporation pays. Oughtn't they at least pony up a pittance from their prodigious inheritance for a few turkey and sweet potato dinners on Thanksgiving? To push for a modicum of fairness, contact www.farrespect.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, going to have Black Friday. You're going to have Small Business Saturday. We're going to have Cyber Monday. How about taking advantage of something that's evidently in its second year, Giving Tuesday? Sounds like a reasonable idea. Give a little bit to your local community. Give a little bit to local organizations that are doing some good. As I've said, I'm a big fan of a number of organizations that I think do outstanding work in my local community, the local food bank, the local shelter, the local Big Brothers, Big Sisters. A lot of these organizations that bring people together and give them ownership of their community, I'm a big fan of. And I think that we should be supporting them. And, you know, just like we go out with the enthusiasm of Black Friday, yeah, Black Friday! And, of course, soon to be Thankless Thursday. Maybe we start thinking about Giving Tuesday. So it'll be interesting to see on that. One of the things Diane brought up were the snap cuts. And to me, it's always amazed me that the people who talk to me the most about family values, the people who preach the most about the family unit, are the ones who are quick to destroy our social safety net. They're the ones who are quick. Wow, we need to cut taxes and we need to cut spending. And cutting spending, where do we do that at? Well, we do that at the programs that help the neediest. You look at our governor, for instance. Our governor decided that the 70,000 of the most vulnerable here in the Commonwealth, that the general assistance budget that gave them, I think it was like $200 a month, that they survived on. And I don't know how you survive on. I literally do not know how you survive on $200 a month. But somehow these folks who are they're at the cliff's edge. This isn't being at the margin. This is being at the cliff's edge looking into the abyss. How you take that last lifeline away and say, you know what, now you truly are on your own, I don't know. And then I don't know how you turn face and say, I'm someone who believes in family values. I don't know how you get that. Much like we're seeing on the federal level, where they're talking about giving huge subsidies to monstrous multinational corporations in the Farm Bill, but we're going to strip out all of the SNAP benefits, all of the food stamps that millions of families in this country rely on. And then we demonize those people. We demonize, well, they're game. I see them with their cards getting candy. I see them with their cards doing this or that. And it's always anecdotal. It's always someone said, I saw you, know. No. I've yet to have one of those stories that someone's told me actually be reality. I've heard a lot of them. But when you throw out, why didn't you call somebody and report it? Oh, I couldn't do that. Well, if they're breaking the law, we should fix it, right? No, it's much easier to complain. It's much easier to point fingers, and it's much easier to make stuff up, which is what I love about these anecdotal stories. Oh, I saw somebody with their EBT card. Really, you could pick that out? You really could pick that card out of the person in front of you? You're really paying that much attention? I find that really hard to believe. And, you know, now's the time of year that you see politicians and celebrities and the such doing these food stamp challenges. Now, admittedly, I have done it once. And it, in my view, was difficult. I hated it. But you know what? I knew that when I started it on Sunday, the next Sunday, I was going to go back to my life. So, you know, I look at this and I go, I don't think that these challenges are worth much. Because it's easy. It's easy to say, well, you know, I can do it for a week. I can do anything for just about a week. There's a huge difference in planning for a week of going hungry than a month of going hungry. It's easier to plan for a month of going hungry than it is for a year or for 2 years or 5 or 10 or, you know what, for an entire lifetime. And, you know, you have people who want to draw attention to it because, you know, you see the limitations. And when I did it, you know, that's what it was to me. Can I actually live on $3 a day? Is that possible? And the sad reality is it wasn't. Unless I was going to eat noodles 3 times a day. And others, they want to do it because, well, I'll show you I can do it because I can tough it out. I can pull myself up by my bootstraps and I can make do because I'm special. And you got those people who do it too, so that they have their talking point. And then you have people who they just do it because they want to destroy the system. Like the college kid who went and bought, I think it was, he got $99 for a month, and he went and bought $99 worth of candy because he could. Because, well, at the end of it, he still had his lunch meal card that he could go to school and go to college and get his meals, which is kind of interesting to me. So it's easy to take pot shots at this. It's easy to tear it apart. And it's easy to, you know, to point fingers at somebody who's struggling. You know, the sad reality, we've allowed. And I remember this growing up. It's one of these memories that I think I will keep with me forever. And I think I've brought it up a couple of times here on the program. I think I was like 8 years old. And my mother had lost her job, and there we had to go on welfare for another stint. Because, you know, look, the 70s, early 70s were not friendly to single mothers. And, you know, if my mother got a job, you know, within several months, you know, she was out the door because, hey, kid got sick, hey, something came up. You know, it's just how things were. So one of the number of stints on food stamps that I remember as a kid, I'll never forget the day that, you know, my mother sent me to the store with these huge cartoonish-looking pieces of paper that were for just to buy food with. And you couldn't buy anything else. You couldn't buy toothpaste. You couldn't buy a toothbrush. You couldn't buy anything other than what was technically considered food. And at the time, she said, you know, you can go pick this, get this, this, and this. And if they have these Nutter Butters, which I just, even to this day, I'm hooked on, the Little Debbie things, that, you know, one of those memories from my childhood of being one of the only treats I ever really got. And I still have it to this day, which I'm, you know, kind of still on. But I remember going through the line as an 8-year-old with this, you know, with a couple of things my mother wanted and this cartoonish looking money and the woman behind the counter just creating this havoc and this scene and this chaos over this, at the time, which was a nickel Nutter Butter. Just one single stick. It was a nickel. And she created this huge scene. And I remember at that time, you know, going, you know, this is horrible, and this is, nobody should ever have to go through this just because they want something to eat. And it's what we're doing every day to folks in this country. Now, I liked the idea of moving to the EBT card because it takes some of that away. But the sad reality is the situation still is what it is, because food stamps don't pay for shoes. Food stamps don't pay for toothpaste. Don't pay for soap or anything else, laundry detergent or any of that stuff. And what's gone on for really far too long, and what's especially in poor neighborhoods. And I can speak volumes to what goes on in these poor neighborhoods. You get these corner stores that open up. That, you know, the guy behind the counter, he's running a lot of backroom deals. Because it's what you can get away with in a poor neighborhood, in a high poverty neighborhood. You get a lot of under the table interest and a lot of, hey, we'll front you a couple of boxes of cereal to the end of the month if you give me a big cut of your food stamps next month. So you're always behind. I mean, it's much like the company store. I mean, you're right back to massive debt and massive owing somebody who's making a killing off of your being in poverty. And I remember saying, someone had a quote not too long ago, it's really expensive to be poor in the U.S. And it really, I mean, absolutely spot-on statement. And I look at this, and I go back, and I read some of these stories. Well, we caught this woman, and she was going to the corner store trading her food stamps for money. And you go, yeah, because generally... Now, the woman recently was buying crack and a whole bunch of other things. And I got to be honest, if I were an adult living in that kind of a situation with no hope forward, I don't know that I wouldn't take to something to block my mental status. But that's a whole other argument for another day. We seem to be fixated on those stories, though, right? And, you know, maybe it's because we think we see it all around us, because it's constantly in our ears and it's constantly being messaged towards us. But we never really talk about the true welfare queens, the true criminals that are destroying our society and screwing up our tax code. And those are the folks who sit in these corner offices. These are the folks who are taking billions of dollars of investment out of our schools and billions of dollars out of our pockets every year on Wall Street. And you go, why aren't we really talking about that? Why aren't we figuring out how we stop that? They don't even need cartoonish-looking money or EBT cards. They just got to... My wife honestly could not believe. And when I bring this up to people, the Bush collapse, if you remember the aftermath, the day after, when Bush had the meeting with Timmy Geithner and Bernanke and the whole Klan got together. We got to save Wall Street. Everything's in free fall. There, you know, this is going on and all. Everything's going crazy. We've got to write the blank check. They gave $750 billion. $750 billion, and it was written on two sheets of paper. Two sheets of paper. That's it. And they weren't even both sides. So we weren't even using that resource well. Two pieces of paper, one page each side. That's it. Two pages. $750 billion. My wife's like, no, that's not, it's true. Those are the strings that came attached with $750 billion to the people who destroyed our economy. Yet, if you want to feed your children, if heaven forbid you need some help paying your electric bill, heaven forbid you need some help paying your rent or your mortgage to get through to the next month so that maybe you got a chance of staying in your house, two pages, you better multiply that numerous times. Because what we do to those folks, what we do to the people without lobbyists, what we do to the people without power, what we do to the people without resource, is we make them jump through hoops, we make them hop obstacles, we make them go through mazes, we make them humiliate and degrade themselves. And then maybe, we'll help. Two pages. I mean, think about that. I mean, it's disgusting, isn't it? $750 billion we were willing to hand over to these criminals. Oh, Rick, you can't call them criminals. They're just capitalists. At the end of it, when you see a situation where they're stealing, literally stealing the future of my children and your children, what other word do you come up with? And I like the quote from Diane Nealon. We must be a really wealthy society that we can throw our children away. And you look at the money that we've taken from public education, just here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, $1 billion each of the years that this governor has been in office. Working on our third billion right now. You look at nationally how much money they've stripped out of education. And you go, don't you think there's a problem? I know. Our taxes are so high. Highest in the history of civilization. I go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Top marginal tax rate. For our one percenters. 92%. Now, understand, they didn't pay 92%. But they paid a sight more than they're paying now. And they invested that money. They invested that money in schools. They invested that money in paying workers better wages. They invested that money in actually building factories and building jobs here in the U.S. We had a tax code that incentivized people staying here. Now we've got a tax code that benefits hoarding your wealth, moving it offshore, and shipping jobs overseas. Tell me that that's the proper tax code. Tell me that's the smart way to go about it. See, I'm a huge fan of really, really high tax rates. I'm not a fan of people paying high taxes. I'm a fan of having high tax rates and that we incentivize certain behavior, like providing health care for workers, like paying decent wages, like having safe working conditions, like having clean air. I'm a big fan of loopholes. Always have been. I say we incentivize things to make people do what's right, and the things that they don't do, they have to pay for. We've kind of gotten away from that. All the externalities we as society, we've decided to fund, while the people who pollute and destroy, they walk away fat, happy, and wealthy. Just seems backwards to me. Let's take a quick break. We're going to come back with hour two. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com is where you get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Airlines mechanics represented by the Teamsters held informational pickets at 10 airports around the U.S. on Monday. They may be forced to strike if the airline doesn't reinstate the workers' pension plans as promised. United's 25,000 AFA-CWA union flight attendants are standing in solidarity with the Teamster mechanics. In 2005, United took away the pensions of 11,000 aviation mechanics, but promised to restore them when the company's finances improved. Now with hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, United Airlines this year had the highest revenue in history in the second quarter. So what happened to the pensions promise? United broke off negotiations with the Teamster mechanics without an agreement to restore the pensions, and United also announced that 3,500 mechanics will pay between $300 and $500 a month more in health care costs. The mechanics want the flying public to know why they may be on strike. The 25,000 United Airlines flight attendants say they stand shoulder to shoulder with their Teamster brothers and sisters on the pension promise issue.
Out in the snow, there's someone out there right now that's stuck in the snow, that's calling AAA, that's waiting for help. But I just want everyone to know that the guys that's showing up a large percentage of the time, if they're coming from Club Assist, they are affected by this lawsuit.
Former roadside assistance worker Maurice Brown. Brown and other AAA contracted roadside assistance drivers have filed a class action lawsuit challenging bad working conditions and low pay, up to 18-hour workdays in all weather and earning as little as $4 an hour. As tens of millions of Americans hit the road for Thanksgiving travel, many will call on AAA for help when stranded on the road. Maurice Brown and other roadside assistance workers want AAA members to know that many roadside assistance workers make less than minimum wage, especially those who work for Club Assist. When Brown and other workers challenged their unfair working conditions and subminimum wage pay, Club Assist, with full knowledge of AAA, decided to call the workers independent contractors, dumping all the costs of doing business onto them. Brown and other AAA contracted road assistance drivers filed their class action lawsuit, and Club Assist fired them. The lawsuit is still pending, and today the workers are filing a Department of Labor complaint. Maurice Brown wants the motoring public to know how the workers who work for Club Assist and respond to AAA calls are being treated.
They're definitely not receiving the minimum wage. They're not receiving any benefits. They're not receiving any overtime pay. They're not receiving any. That. Club Assist devised a plan to put 100% liability and expenses on their workers while they get to make millions of dollars and avoid certain tax obligations.
Walmart has a new CEO, Doug McMillan. Our Walmart member and Walmart worker Tiffany Baroid says it's a testament to the pressure the company is feeling that they're changing CEOs. Baroid says Walmart workers are happy to see the new CEO acknowledge the hard work of Walmart workers. Baroid says our Walmart hopes that this appreciation translates into improving jobs. Walmart workers. As many as 825,000 Walmart workers earn less than $25,000 a year. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So today, there was a vote taken by the Pittsburgh Board of Education. And what's interesting about this is you're sitting in this lame duck session making huge decisions about the future of public education. You've got four of the members who are at the end of their term, so there's no accountability. They're already out the door. But now they have made, from what I understand, they have made a huge decision to, I guess, sell off some of the school buildings and hire teachers from Teach for America. I shouldn't even call them teachers because I don't know if they've actually gotten their 5 weeks of training, which is why we have asked James Sarensky. He is a contributor over at The Nation to come talk to us about Teach for America and maybe a little bit about what's going on there in Pittsburgh. James, thanks for taking time for us. Did I miss him?
Oh, Rick, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, there you go. I got you.
Yeah, hey, how's it going?
I guess not very good. As I look at this, I'm thinking, one, how is it that these four outgoing board members have the ability to vote on this when just in a couple of days, their replacements could have come in and taken this issue up? And then I guess, the quid pro quo, what are they getting out of it, I guess, is my other question down the road.
There are a lot of unanswered questions about Teach for America when you look at their politics across the country. I feel like the debate over the past couple of decades as Teach for America has grown has continued to center on the question of how effective these recruits are. So, they go through 5 weeks of training. They only commit to teaching for 2 years. A lot of folks, depending on the region, come from out of state. But what we see here is the beginning of Teach for America's touchdown in another region. And in turn, the entrenchment of the corporate network that Teach for America is connected to. TSA is a political empire as much as it is a Peace Corps for teachers.
I look at this and I've been saying for years now that there are forces in this country that want to turn the profession of teaching education, if you will, into factory work. Those little kids that come before you, they're little widgets, open their head, you pour in knowledge and stamp out next. The Common Core thing is another example of that. And, you know, when you're talking about 5 weeks of training to be a teacher to educate what I think is the most valuable resource this country has, the next generation, I have to scratch my head because it takes longer than 5 weeks to train a truck driver to drive a truck, yet we're talking about teaching my children in 5 weeks. It just seems ridiculous to me.
Mm-hmm. Rick, the thing about Teach for America is that they are seen by a lot of bureaucrats and a lot of elected officials as a way of diversifying the mix of incoming teachers in a region. And there are studies out there that show, you know, some minimal effects of the impact of TFA core members on students. But really, TFA is emblematic of the broader, you could call it neoliberal, you could call it corporate, you could call it pro-privatization education reform movement, in that they really just get a free pass. And part of the reason for this is that TFA not only has contracts with cities like now Pittsburgh, but with the same large foundations and corporations, up to the tens of millions of dollars, that fund charter school management organizations that are pushing for the sorts of policies that we see taking over the country. So there's a debate that we could have about the impact of TFA recruits, and that impact is very dubious, and we can see the harm of that impact in certain areas. There's another debate that former TFA core members and current core members are already having with their comrades about what the real purpose of TFA is. And we haven't quite seen this debate make it into legislative chambers and into school boards to the extent that I think we will as TFA continues to grow.
Well, my view on it, and this is just purely my view, you don't have to agree or disagree, but my view on this whole TFA, this Teach for America thing, is it's just cheap labor. We can get kids with a lot of energy to come in to work 100 hours a week for a couple of short years. They move on, and we pay them, you know, pennies. I guess I don't even know what the stipend is. They don't get paid hourly, I don't think. I think they get some kind of a stipend, right?
They get the same amount of money that they would get if they were hired as any teacher coming into the school system or into a charter school is contracted by the school system. But still, I mean, we see that TFA will throw out this number of placing more than half of its recruits in traditional public schools across the country. But disproportionately, compared to the spread of charter schools, we see TFA teachers filling a lot of charter slots. And there's no question that there's a lot of politics behind that. So achievement first charter schools are run, more than half of these schools are run by former TFAers. KIPP, the Knowledge is Power program, is run by half former TFA teachers. So what we have here is these networks in place that allow for the TFA folks to come in. And, of course, we know that with charter schools, which by and large are not covered by union contracts, we know that that's going to be cheaper labor. And possibly cheaper education, too.
And that's the thing that gets me. I mean, the same people that are in these little networks and these little worlds that you've spoken of are the same ones who keep saying, we're the same people who are pushing for online higher education. And I've been saying for years, what's going to happen to K-12 education is what's going on right now in higher education, where you've got these very for-profit online institutions that promise the world, deliver very little, but cost huge amounts of money and have really high profit margins while paying their facilitators, because they're not even professors, paying their facilitators pennies. This is the model that they're going to replicate for my kindergartner.
And we see this even more so in urban areas like Pittsburgh, with you know, racially diverse populations, where politicians, you know, are speak in the language of entrepreneurialism. You know, we need creative solutions. And, you know, as we well know, parents, and students and community folks have been clamoring for years, for resources and, you know, for sort of education systems that they know work. So what we have here is, you know, people playing with fire, coming in and trying out all these new things, just like, as you said, with higher ed, with, dubious, if not demonstrably harmful impact.
You know, I find it interesting that all of these silver bullets that they come up with, and, you know, I go back to when I was a kid going to school, they were busing kids from one poor side of the city of Cleveland to the other side of the city, and the kids lost out, the taxpayers lost out, but you know, a handful of bus companies did very, very well. And I look at these silver bullets, never seem to work out for the students, never seem to work out for taxpayers, but seem to be very lucrative for a handful of folks.
That's right. That handful of folks continues to occupy positions of power. And you see, the core members who drink a lot of this Kool-Aid, and I'm hesitant to criticize the individual teachers, but, you know, folks who go through the program and they, you know, they kind of align themselves with the ideology of CSA and this corporate reform movement. We see them, stepping into positions of power. I think what we don't see as much, you know, outside of this pretty big world, you know, big pockets of people is the folks who go through CSA and, you know a state for a state who are critical of it, whether they're critical because of the race politics of CSA or the class politics or folks who are just sick because they're jumping into the classroom without the proper preparation and they're in these no-excuse environments. You know, a lot of people are totally defeated by that. There are a lot of those voices out there. In order to really speak truth to power here, we're going to have to get more of those out of the mix.
And you're going to have to get people out into the streets. And because I believe nothing changes until you have that people in the street kind of pressure. Because, you know, look at this. The reality is and this is factual. I mean, in order to drive a truck in this country, just to get behind the wheel and hold the wheel between two white lines, it takes longer than 5 weeks. So if we're not willing to put somebody on the road driving a truck, how are we going to put someone in front of a classroom of 20, 30, 40, 40 kids and deny them that opportunity in the future?
Well, I'm 24 years old. I graduated college a couple years ago. And it takes more than 2 years to really understand what a community needs. And I think that the resistance movement to Teach for America, which is bubbling up, we saw the first national meeting of critical CSA alums and current core members and community allies this summer in Chicago. The resistance to that is really going to take deep connections with the folks who are already on the street and who are already, you know, out there marching. I think that there's a lot of power there, but it's going to take a lot of work. Got a lot of money on the other side.
Well, you know, and looking at this, I know what the message tomorrow in Pittsburgh is going to be, and I don't know how many Teach for America people they're going to bring in, but I know the message is going to be, well, we brought these people in, it's going to be lower class sizes, even if it's going to mean, in my view, less quality in the classroom. It's just going to be, hey, we've got a warm body there. That's good enough.
I mean, the unfortunate thing is that, you know, it's not even a rational conversation about, you know, tit for tat, more TSA teachers, cheaper labor, and in turn, smaller class sizes. You know, that's not even there. You know, we see the debate, you know, pushed to this direction of, I'm not totally familiar with the Pittsburgh context, but, you know, that, you know, we need blood, basically. And, you know, there's a shortage. Really, I mean, if you ask TSA, or I should say, if you look at TSA's business plan, they're no longer even talking about filling these areas that are in need alone. They're talking about being more proactive about pushing their model with their partners and with their political network to take over. And questions of class size are completely left out of the conversation a lot of the time.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, you brought up, and I've heard that argument, there's a shortage of teachers. We just laid off here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania 20,000 education professionals, be it teachers, classroom assistants. We laid off 20,000 in the last couple of years. There's not a shortage. We've kicked those people to the curb in favor of, in my view, of what I think is going to be not just cheaper labor, but inferior labor.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're lucky enough to get Wendy Kopp, the former CEO and of course founder of TSN, your show at any point, Rick. Maybe you can ask her why after Philly got hit with its doomsday budget earlier this year, she tweeted, and I'm ad-libbing here, something like, "I'm amazed by the amount of progress that that the Philly school system has made." These people are often very tone deaf. You know, that's why you know, we need to keep pushing the pedal to the metal here and not accept, you know, what they say, which is that, you know, we're not a political organization. You know, we're here for the kids, or we're here for you know, for the purpose of education. To stop playing politics with CFA.
So what should we be doing? I mean, you know, what's kind of an action? Because, you know, how locally? I mean, I look at some of the things that are going on, and, you know, as someone who does this program, you know, I think, you know, I should be doing something. You know, what should our listeners be doing? What should parents be doing? Because we're being sold this. Hey, this is the latest, greatest thing. There's shiny doorknobs on the door. This is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's no straight answer to that question, but there are a couple things that the folks are already doing that I think we all should turn our attention to. So there's a group of college students called Students United for Public Education, which has a campaign just getting off the ground to pressure college students not to apply to or go into TSA. We have folks who are doing a lot of important research who are former TSAers, and I was throughout the name Janelle Scott from Berkeley, Sherry Kreshmar from Carroll College, Beth Sundell from University of Wisconsin, who have put out pretty powerful research that I feel like if it were spread far enough, we might even have more teachers' unions who, you know, are a little bit, you know, more willing to draw a line in the sand. So I think we need to really keep pushing the conversation and resist this idea that TSA is an apolitical organization without a much, much larger, much more money-soaked agenda than it lets on.
Yeah, that's why I appreciate you coming and giving us some time to talk about this. You're contributing editor, contributor over at The Nation. Number of articles. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do over at The Nation?
At The Nation, I help edit student writing. So we've actually had a couple of folks from that group, Student United for Public Education, come in. And I have some stuff that American Prospect and Salon focus more on TSA.
And if you want to read some of those, we've got links at thericksmithshow.com. James, it was great talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again at some point in the future.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much, James Saransky, contributor over at The Nation. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We started down the trail of the early history of the establishment of our great American holiday of Thanksgiving. George Washington had established a Thanksgiving Day by presidential proclamation, but his successors left it alone and it became a celebration mostly in New England. Then a crusader named Sarah Hale arose from the citizenry to start an effort to have a national day of Thanksgiving established. She worked hard for the most part of three decades, glorifying pumpkin pie, roasted turkey, and savory stuffing. She wrote of the wonderful season of late November year after year and continually asked for a national legal holiday. Finally, her efforts paid off when President Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday in November a national holiday of Thanksgiving. Many kudos to Ms. Hale for her efforts, but Thanksgiving was soon to take another turn, one of several before becoming an established, unified national holiday in 1956. Join me next time to follow the twists and turns of our Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says Walmart is not big-hearted? Just look at the chain's outlet in Canton, Ohio, where management has set up bins for food donations, asking people to give generously to the poor, who otherwise will not have a Thanksgiving dinner. But the bins are not for customers. They're tucked back in the employees-only area. Walmart's Thanksgiving food drive is for its own employees, beseeching low-wage workers to donate to even lower-wage workers who can't afford a family dinner on this National Day of Thanks. Yes, this corporate colossus, with an annual income greater than 140 countries, wants its poorly paid employees to buy food for fellow employees whose paychecks leave them in deep poverty. More astonishing is the corporation's insipid, self-congratulatory insistence that the employee food drive demonstrates its deep ethical commitment to the welfare of all Walmart associates, as it grandiosely calls its beleaguered workers. The spokesman for the giant asserted that, quote, "This is part of the company's culture, to rally round associates and take care of them." But, of course, the company is not taking care of them at all. It won't pay a living wage, won't provide decent health care or other needed benefits, won't allow workers to organize so they can have their own voice. And then it abandons them to beg for scraps if they want to share in Thanksgiving with other Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is obscene, a moral outrage. Three Waltons, Alice, Robson, and Jim, are heirs to the Walmart fortune and are sitting on more than $33 billion apiece, profiting on the low wages the corporation pays. Oughtn't they at least pony up a pittance from their prodigious inheritance for a few turkey and sweet potato dinners on Thanksgiving? To push for a modicum of fairness, contact www.farrespect.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will till, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christians, right-wing Republicans, straight white American man.
Oh, yes, the promise kept. Promise kept. We're going to fire those 20,000 teachers and support staff. Promise kept. I don't remember that promise, do you? Do you remember the promise that we're going to destroy public education in favor of all of this idiocy? Really? Well, the governor was recently up in Somerset County. He was talking to a group of young Republicans at the Georgian Inn there in Somerset. And he said, you know, I'm not your typical politician. I don't really care about the society as a whole. I care about cutting. He said, your generation and generation of the future will have a better chance because, well, I had funding cuts. And we did that. Promise kept. Yeah, I don't remember. Again, don't remember much of that. He went on to say this is a very diverse state. Schools, he said, are overfunded and underfunded. He said, you almost want to scrap the whole thing. And I look at this and I go, really? Just scrap the whole thing? Part of me goes, okay, for something better, okay, funding formula that would actually make some sense. The part that gets me is, their schools are overfunded. I'm going, yeah, where? Local communities decided they would raise property tax to make sure that their kids had opportunities. I'm not against that. The underfunded part is the one that really, really worries me. And you chose to make that worse. And, you know, It really seems to me every shortcut that we take only makes things worse, only makes things more costly. And I talk about the busing because it's what I knew intimately as a kid. It's the whole reason my mother ended up cleaning the rectory and the church and the priest's house and all of that so that I could go to Catholic school to avoid the busing. And I look at the kids who went to the schools at the time. Their lives were miserable. And now you're going to put these teachers, we're going to put these teachers who have been there 5 weeks training, 2 year commitment, into school districts that as a kid I would have gone to. And then you wonder why those schools are going to be struggling. You know, there used to be something called consistency. There used to be something, you know, that we used to think, you know, it was stability, you know. In high-risk neighborhoods that have neither, something we used to think that would work, although we haven't really tried it. This idea that, well, you know, there's a shortage of teachers, so we need to go out and find and hurry up and train them in 5 weeks. Think about that for a minute. 5 weeks. What are you focusing on in 5 weeks? And some of the stories that I've been reading on this Pittsburgh thing, you've got the one woman, Ellen Smith, who's, you know, one of the former, I think she's the former head of the school district, who said, you know, in 5 weeks, you know, what can you learn in 5 weeks? And in 2 years, you know, what kind of stability is that going to bring us? Now, again, you know, this is one of those moments where I go, you just had the election in November where four of the board members have been ousted. And here, I guess, on the 2nd, which is just, what, Monday? The new board members come in. Now you've got a massive decision that's been made for these board members, a decision that they didn't have any part of, that they had no hand in, that now they're going to have to deal with. The closing of schools, the selling off of real estate. In fact, the one I saw, they sold one. They were talking about selling one of the schools for like $900,000. They were getting $125,000 a year in rent. You know, maybe it's just me, but you know, you start thinking, is that really a smart use of assets? And I'll guarantee you they're going to get some kind of sweetheart deal from the state and a sweetheart deal from the county. And now this, you know, the other part of this that, you know, I keep thinking about is, you know, once we've destroyed public education, are we going to have to start giving schools tax abatements? Are we going to have to start giving them not just abatements, but, you know, free stuff? Here, you know, please bring a school to our district. I mean, how far is this going to go? Now, you got to ask the question, you know, this TFA stuff. And I'm not quite sure that, you know, in what I've read, these Teach for America teachers get a stipend. I don't know that they get the local contracted rate. And I've got to check into that. I know that's what James said, but I'm not quite so sure about it. Because as I've seen this and as I've looked at it, these teachers, it's kind of like a temp agency where, you know, the temp agency gets a finder's fee. Or, hey, we placed a couple of recruits in your area. You're going to have to pay us to bring these people in because they're going to work for basically free. They'll get a couple of bucks. And I look at this and I go, you know, if my kid were going to that school, would I want that? Would I be okay with it? I don't think I am. And then I have to go back to, is this more of what education is going to look like in the future? For the fortunate, and this is what happens when you divide the nation up. This is what happens when you have the two Americas. The Americas where one America where people have resources and the rest of us where they don't. Where if you've got the resource to send your kid to a private school or one of the better schools, your kids are going to have a leg up like none other. And you know what? If you live in a working class, lower working class, poverty-ridden area, something along those lines, sorry, your kids are going to learn how to push buttons. I'm not thrilled. And for me, this whole, all the No Child Left Behind and Teach for America, the Common Core, all of the standardized tests, all of this stuff, just in my view, it's all about destroying public education. It's all about profit, private. Sad stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit about the transportation bill that passed. We're going to have our good friend Abe Amoros on the program to give us the lowdown, the breakdown, what's good, what's bad, all of that. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rich Smith Show.
When you fit in, take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Airlines mechanic.
Presented by the Teamsters held informational pickets at 10 airports around the U.S. on Monday. They may be forced to strike if the airline doesn't reinstate the workers' pension plans as promised. United's 25,000 AFA-CWA union flight attendants are standing in solidarity with the Teamster mechanics. In 2005, United took away the pensions of 11,000 aviation mechanics, but promised to restore them when the company's finances improved. Now with hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, United Airlines this year had the highest revenue in history in the second quarter. So what happened to the pensions promise? United broke off negotiations with the Teamster mechanics without an agreement to restore the pensions, and United also announced that 3,500 mechanics will pay between $300 and $500 a month more in health care costs. The mechanics want the flying public to know why they may be on strike. The 25,000 United Airlines flight attendants say they stand shoulder to shoulder with their Teamster brothers and sisters on the pension promise issue.
Out in the snow, there's someone out there right now that's stuck in the snow, that's calling AAA, that's waiting for help. But I just want everyone to know that the guys that showing up a large percentage of the time, if they're coming from Club Assist, they are affected by this lawsuit.
Former roadside assistance worker Maurice Brown. Brown and other AAA contracted roadside assistance drivers have filed a class action lawsuit challenging bad working conditions and low pay, up to 18-hour workdays in all weather, and earning as little as $4 an hour. As tens of millions of Americans hit the road for Thanksgiving travel, many will call on AAA for help when stranded on the road. Maurice Brown and other roadside assistance workers want AAA members to know that many roadside assistance workers make less than minimum wage, especially those who work for Club Assist. When Brown and other workers challenged their unfair working conditions and sub-minimum wage pay, Club Assist, with full knowledge of AAA, decided to call the workers independent contractors, dumping all the costs of doing business onto them. Brown and other AAA contracted road assistance drivers filed their class action lawsuit, and Club Assist fired them. The lawsuit is still pending, and today the workers are filing a Department of Labor complaint. Maurice Brown wants the motoring public to know how the workers who work for Club Assist and respond to AAA calls are being treated.
They're definitely not receiving the minimum wage. They're not receiving any benefits. They're not receiving any overtime pay. They're not receiving any of that. Club Assist devised a plan to put 100% liability and expenses on their workers while they get to make millions of dollars and avoid certain tax obligations.
Walmart has a new CEO, Doug McMillon. Our Walmart member and Walmart worker Tiffany Baroid says it's a testament to the pressure the company is feeling that they're changing CEOs. Baroid says Walmart workers are happy to see the new CEO acknowledge the hard work of Walmart workers. Baroid says our Walmart hopes that this appreciation translates into improving jobs for Walmart workers. As many as 825,000 Walmart workers earn less than $25,000 a year. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor. And I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, maybe he's pleased, but evidently the voters here in the Commonwealth, not. The latest public policy polling poll just out puts his approval rating around 24%, 65% disapprove. And even with Republicans, only 37% of Republicans approve of the job he is doing, 51% disapproval. Now, this poll was done before the transportation bill was signed. So I gotta wonder, among the 37% of Republicans who do approve of him, or did approve of him then, I wonder, with all of the fee increases and then the gas tax increase, how many of the Republicans who are so anti-tax, it's ridiculous. You gotta wonder how much of that 30%, 37% now approve. On the other side, the Democrats, a number of Democrats, Jack Wagner seemed to lead the poll. He's not even in the race. He led Corbett by 20 points, 50 to 30. And then down the list, you had, you know, Hanger and McCord up by 19, Allison Schwartz up by 15, McGinty, and then so on down the list, Pawlowski and Tom Wolf up by 12. Everybody. And in fact, I think the janitor, if they got down that far, I think the janitor polled much higher than Corbett, which is a good thing, I guess. We can get rid of him. But it just, it's one of those things that grabbed my attention. But he's got something he can hang his hat on. The transportation bill has passed. He got something, pound of flesh along with it. So might help him. Which is why we've asked our good friend Abe Amaros, Pennsylvania Legislative Director, for the laborers to come and talk to us about the piece of legislation that has been passed and signed. Abe, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So I got to be honest, I was kind of surprised. I was surprised that anything got done. I'm not happy with the outcome, but I'm curious your thoughts.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Rick, what you said at the beginning of the program, this segment, was absolutely accurate with the P3 polling. In fact, he's not very popular, and I'm not so sure that this issue is going to propel him into more popularity next year. And if you read some of the newspaper stories that came out over the weekend, you would see that they're being framed as tax increases rather than a comprehensive transportation funding bill that's going to fix our bridges and our roads. So in that respect, I am relieved that there's going to be action and that we could very well avert any catastrophes from taking place in Pennsylvania in 2014 and subsequently. But of course, I mean, this is not a magic solution for him and his reelection efforts. He still has a long way to go in terms of proving to the people of Pennsylvania that he deserves a second term. And, you know, a lot of us were surprised, Rick. I mean, I was in that gallery all week practically last week. I mean, from Monday through Thursday. And when the amendment failed on Monday night, I went home thinking the ball game was over because the Speaker's office had made it clear that if the Mukosey amendment did not pass, then they were just going to call it a week. I mean, they were just going to call it a day, a week, whatever, a month, and go home. But they took another bite at the apple on Tuesday, and then it went to the Senate, where the Senate approved it along party lines and then amended it into a second bill. So after all of the wrangling took place, we had a comprehensive transportation bill on Thursday evening. But again, just like you pointed out at the top of this segment, Rick, it's not going to be an easy lift for him in terms of reelection next year because one issue does not make a reelection effort.
Right. But he's saying, you know, you're going to see it all across the Commonwealth. And I said $2 billion is a step. But, you know, if I remember right, according to his own Transportation Commission, we needed like $3.5 billion, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right, Rick. And of course, that grows by $1 million every day that we have in action. So, I mean, you could pad those numbers even further. But yes, $3.5 billion is what the Transportation Funding Advisory Commission put forth in its study and its publication. But there are a lot of people right now who are relieved that we have something in place, and taxpayers, yes, are going to be squeezed a little bit. By the fifth year, there will be a 28-cent increase in the tax, in the gas tax, and it's going to be there's always a trade-off in terms of these things, and I'm excited about the job creation opportunities here. I mean, it's estimated that this could create up to 60,000 good-paying, family-sustaining jobs in construction for the next 6 to 10 years. So, I'm going to stop short of doing cartwheels in the street, but it is a positive step. It is something in the right direction here. But in terms of this being a political fortune for the governor, I simply don't see it that way.
Well, I don't see it that way either. And I had said a number of times I didn't think it was going to happen because,
right.
You know, it's coming up on an election year. He doesn't want to have to go and say he broke the Norquist pledge because he's increased taxes.
Right. That's exactly right. In fact, Rick, I got to share this with you. I was in the governor's reception room during the impromptu news conference that he held, and the reporters all asked him the same questions. How does this measure up to your no tax pledge? I mean, aren't you setting up your allies, especially on the Republican side, who's also signed the tax pledge, aren't you really setting them up for next year in terms of primary opposition from far-right conservatives? He didn't like the questioning, Rick. I mean, he didn't have his honeymoon after
the signing,
the passage of this bill.
Yeah, wow.
And he was not a happy camper, let me tell you. I saw the look on his face. I saw that his staff had really cut the questions. I mean, Rick, there were only four questions, 4 questions from the news media on a historic piece of legislation, the most significant piece of public policy in 17 years to come out of Harrisburg, in my opinion, and yet his staff wouldn't let him answer more than 4 questions from the news media because he was getting beat up on the no-tax pledge by Grover Norquist. And again, like I said, over the weekend, when you saw the newspaper clips, everything started with your taxes are going up. Your taxes are going up rather than your roads and your bridges are going to be fixed. And that's partially because of his leadership gap and his inability to inspire people to really trust him. Take a look at him and say, oh, yeah, he's doing the very best that he can for Pennsylvania. Because last week, Rick, I got to tell you, the heavy lifting came out of the speaker's office. I mean, that's where the heavy lifting came out of because the Democrats had promised no more than 40 votes for this amendment. In fact, it came down to 39 votes. And they were consistent in their range in terms of producing Democratic votes because obviously the Democrats didn't want a bullseye on their backs in 2014 either because not only could they be primary, but they were also going to have opposition in the fall as well. So, I mean, it was a very sticky political situation for both sides. But I'll tell you, I mean, he didn't know what hit him Thursday night during the questioning because I don't believe he anticipated the news media and the general public really beating him up on the no-tax pledge.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest. When I looked at it and I saw $2 billion, I go, that's almost half. I mean, this has got to be close to the minimum you could have gotten. And as you've said, it's historic that it got passed, which I guess is a sign in itself. But to me, this is the barest of bare minimums. And the other part of this is, it's the pound of flesh. I mean, sure, you raised all the fees, and I guess you could make the argument that they didn't really raise taxes yet. That'll be somebody down the road. It's all fees, and I love that during the Romney years. They didn't raise taxes in Massachusetts. Just raised fees 500 times, which somehow that's not a tax increase. But the other part of this is, you're raising the fees, you're raising the taxes, you're doing all this stuff while simultaneously stealing wages from workers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of unions that were not happy with the result on Tuesday evening. There's no question about it. And it's going to put people to work, but I hope that there's no slippery slope because, Rick, there's still 42 anti-prevailing wage bills out there. And 15 Republicans said no to this bill because they didn't think it went far enough in terms of addressing prevailing wage. So prevailing wage is not off the table. It won't be off the table until there is a Democratic majority in either one of these chambers. And I'm not optimistic that we're going to win the House back. I think we're going to win back some seats. But I don't believe the Democrats are going to win the House back. In terms of the Senate, I think that there's a little bit of room for optimism there to get closer. But by the end of 2014, we may have a new governor, Rick, but the General Assembly will still be dominated by Republicans. And as long as that takes place, prevailing wage is still something that they're going to go after. So we need to remain vigilant. We need to be hold them accountable. Because those 15 no votes on this bill because prevailing wage didn't go far enough, that's what frightens me, particularly for next year and especially in 2015.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, it's a step. I mean, to me, I looked at it, it was the minimum. But I'm now interested in, as this is unfolding, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the projects that are going to be, we're going to be investing in. How much of it is going to be targeted? Is there any language, because I haven't read the bill, is there any language in it that targets, because I know Stephen Bloom, the representative in my area, had wanted to kind of use the politics a little bit and only have bridges built in friendlier districts for Republicans.
Oh, sure.
How much of that is there anything in this that can be looked at this way? Because some of the big projects I've seen are up in the northern part of the state, if you will. I think the biggest one's up in near Williamsport, where I guess the drilling's going on pretty heavily. How much of this stuff is being shuffled around based on politic, in your view?
Oh, well, Rick, in order to get as many Republican votes, and they got 67 Republican votes for the final product, you better believe there was some horse trading involved, and you better believe that the governor's office went to these folks and said, if you don't pony up a vote, we could easily move this project from your neck of the woods to another part of the state. There's no question about it. I mean, the amendment itself, Rick, was 74 pages. The final product was in the hundreds of pages, obviously. So, there was a lot of political horse trading, no question about it. And I know that there are going to be a lot of projects in the Scranton area, the Philadelphia area, in the Pittsburgh region as well. And I know that some of those contracts are going to be let out starting in January or February of 2014. So the Secretary of Transportation is licking his chops right now because he sees a whole a list of projects that could be started in relatively a short period of time. Now, the interesting thing, Rick, is that on Monday night, after the Mikosi Amendment originally failed, Representative Mike Turzai, the majority leader, stood up and offered something similar to what you were talking about in terms of Representative Bloom. He wanted to offer $500 million, which was an absolute insult, where the bridges would have been in about 30 Republican districts, and this would have all been on an emergency basis. So this would have been political plums at their finest, or in my opinion, at their most rotten, simply because this was just being earmarked to give Republicans cover, political cover, in their own districts. Now, the good thing about this was, after about 30 minutes of debate, Rick, with Republicans standing up and bashing the Turzai Amendment, then finally the Speaker banged the gavel and said, well, the gentleman has decided to remove the amendment, to a bunch of cheers in the gallery. He played it out for about 30 minutes, and then when not a single Republican stood up in favor of it, I mean, the jig was up, because there were a lot of ticked-off members in that chamber on both sides when Turzai offered that $500 million amendment. I mean, can you imagine that?
Yeah, I got to be honest.
One-fifth of what was passed, one-seventh of what we needed, according to that report, and, just a slap in the face. So I'm glad that was immediately yanked off the table. And then to his embarrassment, by the way, I mean, he was really chagrined by the end of the evening.
Let me ask you this, as somebody who spends a lot of time there, is he the kid now that wears the kick me sign?
I think so, Rick, because, you know, he wound up, after being an obstructionist twice, he voted for the bill on Thursday. So now I'm thinking, where are your motives? I mean, where is your political and moral courage on these matters? I mean, who are you? And of course, I got to tell you, Rick, he did no heavy lifting on this whatsoever. He was an obstructionist. I viewed him sitting in the gallery on Monday evening when it came time for the vote. This guy was parading up and down the aisles with his thumb down. I thought I was in recess back at St. Mary's School in New York when I saw this. I mean, they were behaving like school children down there. And he was, you know, putting the thumbs down on everything, and then he turns around and he votes for it. So in 2014, I got to tell you, I don't think he's going to be very effective in terms of being a leader. And he had some testy moments with the Speaker. I was told that, things got really, really dicey in the caucus room last Monday evening. And words were said, and, there might have been a little bit of pushing and shoving. Now, I wasn't there, so I was just getting this second and third hand, so it wouldn't be appropriate to say that with 100% certainty. But to say that there's no love lost between the Speaker and the Majority Leader is an understatement. That is a dysfunctional chamber. And I got to tell you, Rick, it goes to play. I mean, what's at play here is a very dysfunctional Republican House and Senate and governor's residence in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's just dysfunctional. They don't get along. They have genuine animosity towards each other. And in the end, it's the taxpayers who pay for that kind of bad relationship and just a lack of faith and trust among their own.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, when they say government doesn't work, they prove it,
yes,
they win.
That's right.
Dysfunctional as they are, their message is still winning. Let me ask you a last question. Now, with the big holiday coming up, curious, what's going to happen in the Amoros family? And I'm curious your thoughts of, we hear the Sarah Palins of the world and the Bill O'Reillys of the world saying there's this war on Christmas. I've been saying there's a war on Thanksgiving. I'm curious, you know, you look at the Walmarts and the big box retailers making workers work on that day, a day of family. I'm curious your thoughts.
Oh, Rick, I got to tell you, corporate greed has really taken front and center stage when it comes to workers. And, you know, you can't blame the workers for working those days because they're trying to care for their families. And in some instances, they're getting, you know, overtime or double time. And I dated a young lady in York whose father worked on Thanksgiving. He was given triple time. And he came home at 5 o'clock. He lived 5 minutes away from the plant. But, you know, today, I mean, the guys at Walmart, they're not making double time. They're not making even time and a half. And, in fact, I was really encouraged to see that in many places around the country, Walmart workers were beginning to really step up, speak out, and say, this is an absolute sham of what they're offering us here. And so these guys don't understand the meaning of Thanksgiving. They don't understand the meaning of giving their workers some time off. And they really don't understand what made America great in the first place. And of course, I mean, there's just no respect towards the workforce whatsoever. I mean, they're still going to come in at ridiculous hours. They're going to start shopping on Thanksgiving Day in anticipation of Black Friday. So, I mean, the big boxes and the corporations are just going to continue to be greedy. And unfortunately, consumers demand it more and more, which is really a shame, Rick. I mean, I understand that there's going to be some specials that start midnight, 12:01 on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, they're gonna,
and that's wrong. Absolutely wrong.
They'll dangle a couple of carrots at us, and we'll go scurry toward them. And for me, my hope was is that, you know, they open the doors on Thanksgiving, and the only thing you hear in those stores are crickets.
I hope so, Rick, because what we're seeing right now is corporate America running amok. And again, I cannot blame those workers who want to provide for their families on that day.
They don't have a choice most of the time.
That's right. Because they have no choice, and it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong.
I'm with you. But I wish you the best of holidays.
Likewise.
I wish you a good day with your family.
Likewise.
I'll tell you who's not going to be there on Thanksgiving. Me. But thanks so much, Abe. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We started down the trail of the early history of the establishment of our great American holiday of Thanksgiving. George Washington had established a Thanksgiving Day by presidential proclamation, but his successors left it alone and it became a celebration mostly in New England. Then a crusader named Sarah Hale arose from the citizenry to start an effort to have a national day of Thanksgiving established. She worked hard for the most part of 3 decades. Glorifying pumpkin pie, roasted turkey, and savory stuffing. She wrote of the wonderful season of late November, year after year, and continually asked for a national legal holiday. Finally, her efforts paid off when President Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday in November a national holiday of Thanksgiving. Many kudos to Ms. Hale for her efforts, but Thanksgiving was soon to take another turn, one of several before becoming an established, unified national holiday in 1956. Join me next time to follow the twists and turns of our Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says Walmart is not big-hearted? Just look at the chain's outlet in Canton, Ohio, where management has set up bins for food donations, asking people to give generously to the poor, who otherwise will not have a Thanksgiving dinner. But the bins are not for customers. They're tucked back in the employees-only area. Walmart's Thanksgiving food drive is for its own employees, beseeching low-wage workers to donate to even lower-wage workers who can't afford a family dinner on this National Day of Thanks. Yes, this corporate colossus with an annual income greater than 140 countries wants its poorly paid employees to buy food for fellow employees whose paychecks leave them in deep poverty. More astonishing is the corporation's insipid, self-congratulatory insistence that the employee food drive demonstrates its deep ethical commitment to the welfare of all Walmart associates, as it grandiosely calls its beleaguered workers. The spokesman for the giant asserted that, quote, "This is part of the company's culture to rally around associates and take care of them." But, of course, the company is not taking care of them at all. It won't pay a living wage, won't provide decent health care or other needed benefits, won't allow workers to organize so they can have their own voice. And then it abandons them to beg for scraps if they want to share in Thanksgiving with other Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is obscene, a moral outrage. Three Waltons, Alice, Robson, and Jim, are heirs to the Walmart fortune and are sitting on more than $33 billion apiece, profiting on the low wages the corporation pays. Oughtn't they at least pony up a pittance from their prodigious inheritance for a few turkey and sweet potato dinners on Thanksgiving? To push for a modicum of fairness, contact www.farrespect.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Prevailing wage was actually discriminatory when it started. I don't think we need to go into the full history of that, but it was definitely meant to keep construction projects local. And we are now in pretty much of a global economy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So my wife had the TV on this morning, and one of those MTV, I think it was pop-up video, was on. And, you know, I was getting dressed, and, you know, the song was playing. I don't even remember which one it was, but the video was shot in Prague. And, you know, one of the pop-ups that caught my eye showed the Charles Bridge there in Prague, which was built in 1357 and still functional. And I'm going, you know, here in Pennsylvania, the average bridge is, I think Corbett said, 51 years old, and he's holding huge chunks of concrete. And look, bottom line, it's because we don't really take care of it. We don't do the maintenance on it. I'm going, if you can keep a bridge functional and you build it well enough that it's going to last today from 1357, Maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe we should be thinking a little bit differently on how we do some of this stuff. And look, you know, this transportation bill, while $2 billion is a lot of money and it's going to actually get some things done, which I'm in favor of, it's still not enough. And the fact, as Abe points out, that our General Assembly is this dysfunctional, that they're this childish, really does not give me great hope, which is why I'm hoping that some sane, rational people will say, you know what, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and get some of these people out, because this, to me, is a no-brainer, an absolute no-brainer. Fix the roads and bridges. Invest in public transportation. It just seems, it seems like common sense. And nothing simpler than that. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. You can email me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com, if something I've said got on your mind, under your skin, made you go, hey, that's a good idea. Maybe we should do more of that. I'd love to hear it. Again, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The kids are united, they can never be defined. Yesterday, there's a brand new sham today.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Airlines mechanics represented by the Teamsters held informational pickets at 10 airports around the U.S. on Monday. They may be forced to strike if the airline doesn't reinstate the workers' pension plans as promised. United's 25,000 AFA-CWA union flight attendants are standing in solidarity with the Teamster mechanics. In 2005, United took away the pensions of 11,000 aviation mechanics, but promised to restore them when the company's finances improved. Now with hundreds of millions of dollars in profits, United Airlines this year had the highest revenue in history in the second quarter. So what happened to the pensions promise? United broke off negotiations with the Teamster mechanics without an agreement to restore the pensions, and United also announced that 3,500 mechanics will pay between $300 and $500 a month more in health care costs. The mechanics want the flying public to know why they may be on strike. The 25,000 United Airlines flight attendants say they stand shoulder to shoulder with their Teamster brothers and sisters on the pension promise issue.
Out in the snow, there's someone out there right now that's stuck in the snow, that's calling AAA, that's waiting for help. But I just want everyone to know that the guys that are showing up a large percentage of the time, if they're coming from Club Assist, they are affected by this lawsuit.
Former roadside assistance worker Maurice Brown. Brown and other AAA contracted roadside assistance drivers have filed a class action lawsuit challenging bad working conditions and low pay, up to 18-hour workdays in all weather and earning as little as $4 an hour. As tens of millions of Americans hit the road for Thanksgiving travel, many will call on AAA for help when stranded on the road. Maurice Brown and other roadside assistance workers want AAA members to know that many roadside assistance workers make less than minimum wage, especially those who work for Club Assist. When Brown and other workers challenged their unfair working conditions and sub-minimum wage pay, Club Assist, with full knowledge of AAA, decided to call the workers independent contractors, dumping all the costs of doing business onto them. Brown and other AAA contracted road assistance drivers filed their class action lawsuit, and Club Assist fired them. The lawsuit is still pending, and today the workers are filing a Department of Labor complaint. Maurice Brown wants the motoring public to know how the workers who work for Club Assist and respond to AAA calls are being treated.
They're definitely not receiving the minimum wage. They're not receiving any benefits. They're not receiving any overtime pay. They're not receiving any of that. Club Assist devised a plan to put 100% liability and expenses on their workers while they get to make millions of dollars and avoid certain tax obligations.
Walmart has a new CEO, Doug McMillon. Our Walmart member and Walmart worker Tiffany Baroid says it's a testament to the pressure the company is feeling that they're changing CEOs. Baroid says Walmart workers are happy to see the new CEO acknowledge the hard work of Walmart workers. Baroid says our Walmart hopes that this appreciation translates into improving jobs for Walmart workers. As many as 825,000 Walmart workers earn less than $25,000 a year.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
So last week, workers in the University of California, the higher ed system out there in California, went on strike. About 22,000 service workers across the system went on a one-day unfair labor practice strike. And we're joined by some 15,000 graduate student employees and, you know, in campus workers and folks across the system for one day to just say, hey, you know what? We're united and we're serious. And I've always said, look, you know, strikes are the absolute last resort. It's the last arrow in the quiver, if you will, but sometimes it works on, you know, kind of shocking things back into movement in the right direction. And I'm hoping this is part of it. But I found it interesting that, you know, one of the professors in the system decided that he was going to cross the line, and I'm interested in the fallout, which is why we've asked Caroline McCusack. She's a PhD student in the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She was one of the participants. I want to ask her about that. Caroline, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You know, explain, you know, why are you involved in this? You know, some would say, you know, this is between the campus workers, like this guy who wrote the email and crossed the picket line. Oh, it's not your fight; it's somebody else's. Why are you involved?
Well, this strike was a very inspiring example of solidarity between our campus unions, and I think if Professor Coward had done a little more research on the strike, he would have found out that it wasn't aimed at disrupting education. Far from it. These service and patient care workers who went out on strike and who our union joined in a sympathy strike have been experiencing intimidation and harassment, and they've also been crucial to the fight to save the University of California system. They were involved in efforts to fight for a tuition freeze of the proposed 81% tuition hike that students were facing a few years ago, and those efforts were successful. And now those same workers who contributed to the fight for public education are making so little money that they themselves are scared their children won't be able to go to the University of California, and they're bullied when they speak up about their concerns with the way the university is running. So it was important for us to show solidarity that day, and I wish that people who crossed the picket line had done a little more research on this struggle.
Is his name really, really Professor Coward?
It is. His name is Alex Coward.
Yeah, that's kind of, well, I'm not gonna say that it's fitting, I guess. But, you know, I looked at what he read, and I did read his email thoroughly, and he does say, you know, I could be wrong. And I think he is, but one of the passages that caught my attention, he said, whatever the alleged injustices are that are being protested about tomorrow, it is clear that you are not responsible for those things, whatever they are, and I don't think you should be denied an education because of someone else's fight that's not you're not responsible for. And I take that message of, well, you know, it doesn't affect you, so you shouldn't care. I take that very, very seriously because that's not what I want the next generation to learn. It's not what I want my kids to think, that if there's an injustice somewhere that you just go, oh, it's not my problem. Let someone else deal with it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think the workers who went out on strike that day could absolutely see that not only was it important to stand in solidarity with campus workers, but that the struggles of the workers and the students are completely tied up together and that it's the UC administration that has public education in its sights. And that's the real threat to our education. So that's what's led our unions to be involved in this fight. And I wish that Professor Coward had seen that.
Yeah. So, like I said at the beginning of this, I'm a believer that, you know, strikes should be the last resort. And I'm sure in this situation, it's one of those last resort things to kind of maybe jumpstart things at the bargaining table. What has been the aftermath of the one-day strike? What's transpired since then?
Well, one worrying element of aftermath has been that we've seen a lot of intimidation from across the University of California campuses. Some examples were that at UCLA, administrators were telling international students that they could lose their visas and get deported if they went on strike or were seen at the picket line. At UC Irvine, we heard there were administrators actually coming to classrooms of our members who were on strike and harassing their students about their teaching assistants' participation. There's been widespread reports of administrators illegally polling people about participation in the strike and also about filming our members. So we want to look into this more and do everything we can to stand up for our members who are experiencing intimidation over their participation here. But overall, I think the members who participated, the strike was a very inspiring experience. You know, one of our members here at Davis met some service workers on the picket line, had some conversations with them, and started a petition asking the UC administration to take a 1.5% pay cut instead of asking AFSCME workers to take a 1.5% pay cut.
Yeah,
so although there were negative fallout items that happened, we've also seen a lot of solidarity that was generated by the strike.
Yeah, I listened to you lay this out, and, you know, the intimidation, the harassment, that, I mean, that's something I would expect from the Walmarts of the world, from the big box retailers or some of these union bus, not an institution of one of the more respected institutions of higher learning on the entire planet. I wouldn't expect that from them. I guess I'm kind of surprised at it.
Well, it's also very worrying that 99% of these AFSCME workers are eligible for public assistance in the state of California, and paying workers very low salaries and relying on public assistance to support them is entirely a tactic that we would expect from Walmart, not from the University of California, especially in the context of the top executives receiving perks, pay raises, and high salaries while asking workers to take a pay cut, increasing the size of classes, pushing costs onto the students and workers, and themselves taking pay raises. So they're absolutely behaving
like Wall Street.
Out of the character. Yeah, like Wall Street, and not like people who we should really be entrusting with the future of our education.
Yeah, and I go back to this, you know, it's not your fight mentality, which to me is really kind of a disgusting thought in my view, but it is what seems to be permeating our society that, well, you know, that's them, and it's not going to affect you, but in reality, especially when you're talking about graduate assistants and folks like that, you know, it is, or teachers, you know, I look at the assault on public sector workers, teachers, and cops and firefighters, you know, those are jobs that those graduates at some point may go into, so it really is their fight.
Yeah, it's absolutely students' fight. And in addition, a lot of the asking workers are immigrants. A lot of them are first-generation immigrants. A lot of them are people of color. So being told that their fight isn't the same fight that everyone else has can be really insulting and really create a hostile atmosphere on the UC campuses for people of color. And, you know, we as TAs, we are the ones educating the students of California. We do most of the frontline educating at the university. And so I think it's very important that students pay attention to our fight because the situation has gotten pretty grim here at the University of California.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, what's the fallout been for the scab professor who crossed the picket line?
I don't know. I've heard that he's gotten some angry emails, but I've also heard that he's gotten emails from students who were inspired by him. So I don't think he's going to face any fallout. In fact, the UC administration has been promoting his letter and sharing it and telling people that it's a very inspiring letter, which shows that they're trying to co-opt it into their, you know, propaganda campaign against the unions.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the fallout and down the road how that gets played out, because I'm always interested to see how the propaganda works in these campaigns, because having been part of a number of organizing campaigns, a number of different strikes over the years, it's always interesting to see how the other side uses things like this.
Definitely, that's true. It seems that they have certainly a strategy of intimidating and dividing the students and workers. I mean, the strike on November 20th was originally precipitated by intimidation against AFSCME workers, and now we're seeing similar intimidation and negative propaganda coming out after this most recent strike. So it seems that UC must have some kind of coordinated campaign here, and it's very worrying.
In your opinion, does it look like this is an attempt to break the unions, or just attempt to do what employers in corporate America have been doing to workers, unionized workers across the country, which is just extracting as much as they can from them? Because hey, just be glad you got a job, even if you need to collect food stamps or heating assistance or health care from the state to make it through the end of the month.
Oh, it certainly looks like union busting to me. The UC administration recently completely went around the collective bargaining process and implemented a contract on the AFSCME workers. And what implementing a contract means is that they forced them to take a pay cut, they forced them to take cuts in their benefits, and that seems like union busting, plain and simple to me. And in addition to that, the UC administration has a long history of attempting to fight the formation of unions. Our own union for teaching assistants only won its right to collective bargaining through very, very hard struggle and massive on-the-ground mobilizations. And to this day, the UC administration continues to insist that the research assistants on campus aren't workers and therefore shouldn't have a right to collective bargaining. So union busting is increasingly a part of the UC administration's tactics, I think.
Yeah, it's sad to see our institution of higher learning taking the Wall Street path. Especially a place like UC Berkeley, I mean, that just caught my attention and struck me as troubling.
Yeah, it was very troubling. But thankfully, the spirit is still alive in Berkeley. I mean, on the strike on November 20th, Berkeley members were out there in the rain, singing songs, marching on administrative buildings. So I think the spirit of Berkeley protest is far from dead, whatever the administration would let you to believe.
Yeah. But where do you see this going in the coming days, weeks, and months? I mean, is this going to be a long, drawn-out battle? How do you see this? How are they viewing this with the folks involved?
Well, I think our battle certainly continues. Our union is still in contract negotiations with the university for a new contract, and we're hoping to work closely with the AFSCME workers in the future. And we're also hoping to draw in more students and show the world that we are in a fight for higher education and for public education. We're in a fight to save this institution that we have all benefited so much from.
Yeah,
so.
It's the same discussions we have with professors here in the Pennsylvania state higher education system, you know, and why the students need to be involved, because it is their future. The situations that these professors work under, that's their future as well. And it's something that I hope more college kids get involved in and lose this mentality. Well, that's somebody else's problem. It's not mine.
Yeah, I agree. Poverty wages for campus workers like teaching assistants and service workers really are a direct danger to the students of this university and to the people of California and to the future of California. I think that goes for public universities across the country, which have been under assault in recent years. But I think our movement is a really inspiring example of what can be accomplished when students and workers get together.
And get out in the streets. I mean, that's the part that I think is most important. Where you see boots on the ground, people in the streets. The whole reason I view the minimum wage issue as coming around and actually having any legs whatsoever is that we're seeing Walmart workers and fast food workers and all these retail workers in the streets saying, hey, we want an increase in our wages. And I'm so happy to see unionized workers and public sector workers saying, hey, you know what? We're not going to take the abuse and the assaults any longer. We're going to take to the streets and fight back. I think that's what has to happen.
I absolutely agree. Everything we've gotten, we won through struggle. Nobody gave it to us. We won it through our solidarity with others, and we won it through hard fights.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking forward to the coming days.
Well, I appreciate you taking time for us, Caroline. I look forward to more updates on what's going on, and I hope you come back and give us some good news.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Caroline McCusick, PhD student there at the Department of Anthropology at the University of California, Davis, talking about last week's one-day strike. I'm still interested in that whole message. It's not your problem. Don't worry about it. I'm going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7435.
Show. Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've started down the trail of the early history of the establishment of our great American holiday of Thanksgiving. George Washington had established a Thanksgiving Day by presidential proclamation, but his successors left it alone and it became a celebration mostly in New England. Then a crusader named Sarah Hale arose from the citizenry to start an effort to have a national day of Thanksgiving established. She worked hard for the most part of three decades, glorifying pumpkin pie, roasted turkey, and savory stuffing. She wrote of the wonderful season of late November year after year and continually asked for a national legal holiday. Finally, her efforts paid off when President Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday in November a national holiday of Thanksgiving. Many kudos to Ms. Hale for her efforts, but Thanksgiving was soon to take another turn, one of several before becoming an established, unified national holiday in 1956. Join me next time to follow the twists and turns of our Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says Walmart is not big-hearted? Just look at the chain's outlet in Canton, Ohio, where management has set up bins for food donations, asking people to give generously to the poor, who otherwise will not have a Thanksgiving dinner. But the bins are not for customers. They're tucked back in the employees-only area. Walmart's Thanksgiving food drive is for its own employees, beseeching low-wage workers to donate to even lower-wage workers who can't afford a family dinner on this National Day of Thanks. Yes, this corporate colossus with an annual income greater than 140 countries wants its poorly paid employees to buy food for fellow employees whose paychecks leave them in deep poverty. More astonishing is the corporation's insipid, self-congratulatory insistence that the employee food drive demonstrates its deep ethical commitment to the welfare of all Walmart associates, as it grandiosely calls its beleaguered workers. The spokesman for the giant asserted that, quote, this is part of the company's culture to rally around associates and take care of them. But of course, the company is not taking care of them at all. It won't pay a living wage, won't provide decent health care or other needed benefits, won't allow workers to organize so they can have their own voice, and then it abandons them to beg for scraps if they want to share in Thanksgiving with other Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is obscene, a moral outrage. Three Waltons, Alice, Robson, and Jim, are heirs to the Walmart fortune and are sitting on more than $33 billion apiece, profiting on the low wages the corporation pays. Oughtn't they at least pony up a pittance from their prodigious inheritance for a few turkey and sweet potato dinners on Thanksgiving? To push for a modicum of fairness, contact www.farrespect.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do?
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, today, the year 2000, how many people remember today in the year 2000? I remember it clearly, as crystal clear as I can remember just about any day. This is the day that Catherine Harris, remember the name Catherine Harris, the Florida Secretary of State? Today is the day that she certified the shrub as the winner of the presidential election there in Florida. Today she certified Catherine Harris. And look, it's amazing to me. You go and you look at the aftermath and then all of the insanity that ensued around her. And there was never a question that she was going to certify it. In fact, you know, there's numerous videos of every opportunity for her to usurp the law in one way or another. And, you know, I think back to that moment, and, you know, I was having the conversation with the kids today, and it was just one of these really bizarre conversations you start having with your kids when they start asking questions about, evidently they know that Michael Jackson was cryogenically frozen, or they think he was. And they said, you know, are they going to bring Michael Jackson back at some point? I'm going, well, you never know. I mean, if you got the money, you know, who knows what the future holds. And I said, you know, the three of you have got cord blood that we stored in case you get sick and down the road, who knows what the stem cells will be able to cure. And they said, you know, if you could bring someone back, who would you bring back? And, you know, we were having these conversations about, you know, different people throughout history and different moments in time. And, you know, with the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, you know, my daughter's like, would you bring back John F. Kennedy? And I said, well, you know, if I could put him in that moment in time, because I think the world would be a completely different world. I don't think we would have gotten into Vietnam. I don't think a lot of the things that transpired in the aftermath would have happened. Just my thought. I mean, we can have the argument back and forth one way or another. But, you know, in that moment in time, and I look at the year 2000 as another one of those moments in time where that if you could go back and like Sandra Day O'Connor said, I think I made a mistake. If you could go back to that moment in time and right the wrong, maybe we're not in the situation where, and maybe 9/11 never happens. Maybe we don't take our eye off the ball. Maybe you don't have the entire intelligence apparatus with the wide swing in the way that it went. Maybe the August 6th presidential daily briefing gets read. Maybe, you know, maybe it happens. Who knows? But I go back to that moment, you know, and, you know, just 13 years ago, and you think about the difference in the entire direction of the country over that moment in history, and the entire country based on what happened in Florida. And what I find ironic, and in the aftermath, you get to look back, and a number of newspapers got together and actually paid to have the votes counted and had them counted in a number of different ways. And this is the irony, and I guess the kind of comical irony of the 2000 election and of Al Gore. You know, I was never a huge Al Gore fan, to be honest. He was much better than George W. Bush, but, you know, not in my opinion, the greatest either. But I guess it goes back to that decision. You know, he made that first decision of picking Trader Joe Lieberman as his running mate, which I would have never done. But when the consortium of newspapers came together and counted the votes, and in every way conceivable, they found out that Al Gore won in every conceivable fashion, in every way that everyone was asking for, except the one way that he was asking for, which I guess is kind of funny, and I guess, you know, it's one of those historical ha-has, if you will. But I find it interesting that here we are 13 years later, 13 years after Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State there in Florida, certified George W. Bush as the winner in Florida, that the Secretary of State, Ken Detzner, is now changing the absentee ballot rules ahead of the 13th District Congressional special election coming up. Bill Young passed on, and there's going to be an election shortly to replace him in the 13th Congressional District, which I find interesting. The 13th Congressional District, now this is, you know, gerrymandering afterwards, you know, Young is now the guy. The 13th Congressional District is where Catherine Harris served two terms after she you know, locked it in for Bush. I just thought that was ironic and a historical irony as well. But, you know, what they're doing is they're changing how absentee ballots are being turned in. It used to be that you could drop them off in several locations. And now, according to the change, the Secretary of State, this Ken Detzner, is saying, you know, you can no longer drop the absentee ballots off at the library or tax collector's office or other places of official. You can only drop them off at the specific election office. They can only be mailed into that one place. And what they're saying is, you know, you've got Detzner saying, well, we're just trying to add some uniformity. You know, a couple of weeks before a special election that I guess is up in the air at this point. It could go to a Democrat. And this is a seat that's been for decades held by a Republican. And there's an opportunity for the Democrats to pick it up. So what I find interesting that now you've got the Florida Secretary of State in a very Catherine Harris-esque way, saying, well, we're gonna change the rules midstream. So, you know, it's not a big deal. Yeah, it's a huge deal. If you're someone who has voted absentee every time you voted, and you've always taken it to the local library, you've always taken it to the local, you know, tax office, or you've always taken it to any of these other places that have for years been taking them, you've kind of got a habit of doing it. And now if you do that, what's going to happen? Well, they're going to throw those out. Now, understand, you know, they've done some specific studies, and they find that a large number of Democrats tend to use these drop-off sites. In fact, what I found really kind of telling, and in the story, in a quote from the Pinellas County Supervisor of Elections, is Deborah Clark. Her reaction is it's about suppressing the vote. She said she's very worried about it, and she's actually stunned. The county has used drop-off sites since 2008 and used 14 of them in 2012's general election when 42% of the county's absentee ballots were left at drop-off sites. 42% of the vote was left in these drop-off sites. Now, understand, in Florida, you've got 8.6 million votes in 2012. 8.6 million. 2.4 million people voted absentee. 28%. If you can somehow hold down that vote, who do you think has got a better chance of winning? Especially when you're talking about doing it in areas where people may not be as connected. I see this and I look at this as just another attempt by the Republicans to suppress the vote. Another way of trying to put up roadblocks and obstacles and mazes in way in front of folks so that they don't have the ability to exercise their vote. And I know, but Rick, you know, you should be able to send it where it's supposed to go, right? Yeah, but here's the thing. We both know, and we all know. If you get into a habit of doing something and you're used to, hey, I've always taken it at this place, that's how you do it. And they know that there's going to be a percentage of folks they're just going to do what they've always done. And this insidious, another way of trying to hold that vote down. And I go back to, you know, our governor here, the most unpopular governor in the country right now. And I guess that's something, right? That's something to be proud of. We've got a governor who's the least popular in the country. I remember in 2010 when he said, if we could just hold down the vote in Philadelphia. Well, how did you expect to hold down the vote? And that was a very, very honest, true comment, if you think about it. And the language was honest. We could just hold it down. Well, explain to me how that was going to happen. Oh, yeah. Caging. Changing polling places. Whole bunch of stuff. Just really very flat wrong in my view. So it'll be interesting to see how this election turns out for Bill Young's seat, which, like I said, for decades has been held by a Republican. It's now, I guess, a toss-up at this point. So it will be interesting. Here in the 11th hour, going to change the rules. Do you think that's right? Do you think that's fair and just? Or is it, hey, we've got the power, we can abuse it however we want? Because that's how I see this. It's the same thing in Ohio in 2004 when J. Kenneth Blackwell arbitrarily changed the rule, saying, well, we're not going to take voter registration unless it's on 80-weight paper. They didn't even make voter registration on 80-weight paper. And you got to go, you know, what is it with the Republicans and their commitment to suppressing the vote? What is it with the commitment to keep you and me and others from the ballot box? Do you have a thought? Do you have a question? Do you have a comment? Do you think of that? I mean, because wait till next year comes around. I'm waiting to see what our Secretary of State does. I'm waiting to see what Corbett's person does. How are they going to use the voter suppression here? Are we going to see more of the buses saying, hey, you have to show your ID or don't bother showing up, even though it's not the law? Are we going to spend millions more dollars pushing a law that's not even in place just because they know? And as the Republican chairman here in Pennsylvania, Gillespie, said, well, Obama beat McCain by 10%, by 10 points, only beat Romney by 5, voter suppression. Voter ID had a little bit to do with that. We know it had a lot to do with it. And they know it, which is why they're pursuing it. Because the only way they can win is by holding down the vote. That simple. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
For the homeless, for the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the Vulcan dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. United Airlines mechanics represented by the Teamsters held informational pickets at 10 airports around the U.S. on Monday. They may be forced to strike if the airline doesn't reinstate the workers' pension plans as promised. United's 25,000 AFA-CWA union flight attendants are standing in solidarity with the Teamster mechanics. In 2005, United took away the pensions of 11,000 aviation mechanics, but promised to restore them when the company's finances improved. Now with hundreds of millions of dollars,
$1 billion in profits. United Airlines this year had the highest revenue in history in the second quarter. So what happened to the pensions promise? United broke off negotiations with the Teamster mechanics without an agreement to restore the pensions, and United also announced that 3,500 mechanics will pay between $300 and $500 a month more in health care costs. The mechanics want the flying public to know why they may be on strike. The 25,000 United Airlines flight attendants say they stand shoulder to shoulder with their Teamster brothers and sisters on the pension promise issue.
Out in the snow, there's someone out there right now that's stuck in the snow, that's calling AAA, that's waiting for help. But I just want everyone to know that the guys that are showing up a large percentage of the time, if they're coming from Club Assist, they are affected by this lawsuit.
Former roadside assistance worker Maurice Brown. Brown and other AAA contracted roadside assistance drivers have filed a class action lawsuit challenging bad working conditions and low pay, up to 18-hour workdays in all weather and earning as little as $4 an hour. As tens of millions of Americans hit the road for Thanksgiving travel, many will call on AAA for help when stranded on the road. Maurice Brown and other roadside assistance workers want AAA members to know that many roadside assistance workers make less than minimum wage, especially those who work for Club Assist. When Brown and other workers challenged their unfair working conditions and sub-minimum wage pay, Club Assist, with full knowledge of AAA, decided to call the workers independent contractors, dumping all the costs of doing business onto them. Brown and other AAA contracted road assistance drivers filed their class action lawsuit, and Club Assist fired them. The lawsuit is still pending, and today the workers are filing a Department of Labor complaint. Maurice Brown wants the motoring public to know how the workers who work for Club Assist and respond to AAA calls are being treated.
They're definitely not receiving the minimum wage. They're not receiving any benefits. They're not receiving any overtime pay. They're not receiving any of that. Club Assist devised a plan to put 100% liability and expenses on their workers while they get to make millions of dollars and avoid certain tax obligations.
Walmart has a new CEO, Doug McMillan. Our Walmart member and Walmart worker Tiffany Baroid says it's a testament to the pressure the company is feeling that they're changing CEOs. Baroid says Walmart workers are happy to see the new CEO acknowledge the hard work of Walmart workers. Baroid says our Walmart hopes that this appreciation translates into improving jobs for Walmart workers. As many as 825,000 Walmart workers earn less than $25,000 a year.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. Let's go to Washington, D.C. for Talk Radio News. We've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. How are you doing tonight, Ellen?
I am doing okay, and Thanksgiving is just around the corner.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the big day, day of football and family. At least in my household, it's still going to be family time. You know, look across the country at all of this attack, the war on Thanksgiving. Where's Sarah Palin and Bill O'Reilly in this? I've yet to hear them talk about this at all, the war on words, because most people will say, hey, happy holidays, because I respect you might be different than me. Happy holidays. But nothing on the war on Thanksgiving, making workers work on Thanksgiving, which has been historically a family day.
That's right. And so what are they saying now?
Nothing. I've heard nothing out of either one of the talking heads. I've heard nothing out of the family values Republicans. Nothing.
Well, they just assume, I guess.
And, you know, right. What happened to the whole family values thing? What happened to the party of family values?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Science Times today, which is a every Tuesday section of the New York Times, has done a whole thing on different families, and that they say that sociologists are changing so fast the definition of American family, not just because they're gay people, but because of people's chosen families, because we have so many people more now in prison, and other people are taking care of kids. There's a very interesting article in the demographic, even in the last year, they said, in how fast American families are changing.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the definition of family is fairly fluid. To me, it's who you choose to spend your time with and who you tend to love and care about and your inner circle, if you will, more than blood relatives, because as you've said, you know, look, the family unit is kind of changing, but even still, the people who talk about family values, and I don't care how you define a family, shouldn't they be the ones out on the forefront saying, look, you know, can't we take one day off from capitalism? Can't we take one day to give families a break and say, you know what, stay home, enjoy each other, enjoy your day? Does it all have to be the bottom line?
That's right. That would be nice, right? Right. And, of course, now you have some stores that are opening up at 8 o'clock p.m. Thanksgiving night.
Well, my wife, I took the kids to breakfast this morning in the restaurant we're going to, and they were touting, hey, we're going to be open all day Thanksgiving. I'm going, you couldn't even take that day off.
Well, restaurants,
I know.
Okay.
I know.
Maybe. But
no.
A store?
Yeah. It's insane to me. And look, to be honest, there's nothing there I really want anyway, especially to take the day away from my, I don't get all that many days to spend with my kids. So why would I take one of the very few where school is still off for now? Why would I take one of those days away from them? It's just insane. Let's move along. Let's talk about what's going on. I see the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on who
they're going to be taking that new case. That's correct.
So who now is going to dictate if my wife or my daughters choose at some point to have birth control or, not just for birth control, but contraception?
It depends. If you work for one of these two companies, Hobby Lobby and this other company in Pennsylvania, actually, right?
Yeah.
They are saying they don't want to pay for birth control. They don't want to pay for contraception because it's against their religious values. But it's not a religious corporation at all.
And are we going to start, is there going to be a defining line if, and I understand a religious corporation somewhat. Are we going to start defining companies based on their religious ideology then? Is that where we're going?
I mean, what some people are saying, and what one of my hosts said, well, he deals a lot with the Catholic Church, and if you don't like their values, don't go work for them. Well, it's not like jobs are so plentiful. Sometimes you want to just go work for a job.
Yeah, and to me, this is another reason why we take health care away from employers. And I don't even know why employers want the headache or the hassle of health care, other than it's a controlling factor. To me, this is why we mingle pair. We need to get away from the employer-based system and get it to a citizen-based system.
Right. Well, that would be nice. But the problem is that companies consider themselves to keep their values as a company, and if you have a religious person who's head of a company, well, they think that they can impose their views on everybody, including their health insurance.
Yeah, to me, it's nuts. And from the beginning, when this whole thing broke, I said, this is a worker issue. It's not a religion issue. Because then where does it end? I mean, if this is the case, where do we then take this? What's the next step? Well, I'm Catholic. We don't eat meat on Fridays during Lent, so none of you can either. And if I find out that you're doing it in your own home, you're fired. Is that where we're heading next?
Hopefully not. I think the Supreme Court's going to be weighing in on this.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. I'm not, with this Supreme Court, I'm not hopeful. Anyway, what's going on? I understand the UN Human Rights Council had a statement or a meeting.
The Human Rights Council did have a statement today, and this had to do, well, they actually voted, this is Brazil and Germany, to extend and to be concerned about human rights. Fine was their main issue by government on either their people or other governments. It will come up for a vote before the General Assembly, and it is, of course, non-binding.
Yeah. Yeah, as a lot of that stuff is. Going back to the religion thing for a second, because it just popped into my head. The more I listen to this Pope, the more I read about what this guy's putting forth, the more maybe the Catholic Church should start listening to him.
Let's hope that they do. He's determined to change some things there. That would be nice.
And I've been saying from the beginning, and you can say you heard it here first, he better break out the Pope mobile and soon. Because if he keeps talking like that, he keeps talking about that politicians and people should start getting their constituents and their citizens dignified work, education, health care, really food, shelter. Are you kidding? Who would have said such a thing? Who would speak such heresy?
Good question. That's the problem. He's going to be in some trouble, but he is the Pope.
Yeah.
And particularly since he taken after that guy in Germany who's building that
monstrosity of,
residence.
Tens of millions of dollars wasted away while there are people literally starving every day in this country. And what I like about this Pope is he actually practices what he preaches. I guess he lives in the guest house, doesn't even live in the grand palace of the Vatican.
Exactly, and he lives with other priests.
Yeah, as I told my wife, I may actually go back to the Catholic Church if I could ever get over the beatings that I sustained as a child. The scars.
Oh, my gosh.
I went to Catholic school for a number of years. Not good memories. Good education. Good education. They beat it into me, literally. But, you know, not good memories. Let's talk about Iran, the big deal over the weekend. Lots of people saying, revisiting the Joe Plummer, a vote for Obama is the death to Israel. Nonsense. I'm curious your thoughts on the grand deal.
Well, you know, my thoughts are that if we can negotiate something and we establish a relationship and we lift some of the sanctions for 6 months, I don't think it's a big deal. They're not going to be able to enrich enough uranium in that period of time to get a bomb. I think we're safe, and we should just go with the relationship and try and lift some of the sanctions.
And at the end of this, isn't this really an attempt to reach out to the Iranian people to say, hey, look, you know, all the stuff you're hearing about us may not be actually accurate, and maybe trying to get them to, you know, start rising up and taking some direct action there?
Well, that would be good, right?
Well, it couldn't be bad.
Right, exactly. So actually, I think even Senator Corker, Republican from Tennessee, came away from his meeting with the president and said this was going to be a good thing.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
And he was not going into the meeting with that.
Wow. Well, good. All I kept hearing is, well, this is a distraction from Obamacare, and it's the train wreck that's that, and we're just changing the subject. And I'm going, no, I think this has been a long-term negotiation kind of thing. This is something that they've been wanting to do, that Kerry's been wanting to do for some time.
Yes.
Yeah. Any word on if we're going to be asking for the, they're holding one of our, FBI agents?
Right. Bob Ney just emailed me and said, listen, this is not the time to ask for it. The president was right not to ask for this American citizen, but should wait until there's more of a relationship established. Not a bad idea.
Yeah. So let me ask you, what are you doing for the big Thanksgiving holiday? I know you guys
I'm
going
to go to the parade.
All right.
And then I'm going to have dinner with my family, and then I'm going to get up at 5 in the morning and go to Macy's and get my picture taken with Santa Claus and my foster son.
God bless you. 5 o'clock in the morning, huh?
Well, you know what? I love to see what people are buying. I love to see how many people are there. I sort of people watch, and I like to have my picture taken with Santa Claus. What are you doing?
At 5 o'clock in the morning, I can guarantee you I'll be sleeping.
Okay. You go to sleep, I'll go to Macy's.
I can tell you I'm not going to be going anywhere near any of the stores on Black Friday. There's a reason it's Black Friday. I want no part of it. I will spend the day with my kids. We'll have a fun day together. And to me, that's what the season is about.
It is. It is.
And that's what the holiday is about, being thankful for health and family. And
it
being,
is. And I like seeing Santa Claus.
There you go. Okay, well, I hope you're the best sitting on Santa Claus's knee, and you'll have to send us a picture.
I will do so. Thank
All right.
you.
Thanks
have
so much.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You do as well. Our good friend Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Together we will live on forevermore. Defended from all things unholy. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We started down the trail of the early history of the establishment of our great American holiday of Thanksgiving. George Washington had established a Thanksgiving Day by presidential proclamation, but his successors left it alone and it became a celebration mostly in New England. Then a crusader named Sarah Hale arose from the citizenry to start an effort to have a national day of Thanksgiving established. She worked hard for the most part of 3 decades, glorifying pumpkin pie, roasted turkey, and savory stuffing. She wrote of the wonderful season of late November year after year and continually asked for a national legal holiday. Finally, her efforts paid off when President Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday in November a national holiday of Thanksgiving. Many kudos to Ms. Hale for her efforts, but Thanksgiving was soon to take another turn, one of several before becoming an established, unified national holiday in 1956. Join me next time to follow the twists and turns of our Thanksgiving holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says Walmart is not big-hearted? Just look at the chain's outlet in Canton, Ohio, where management has set up bins for food donations, asking people to give generously to the poor, who otherwise will not have a Thanksgiving dinner. But the bins are not for customers. They're tucked back in the employees-only area. Walmart's Thanksgiving food drive is for its own employees, beseeching low-wage workers to donate to even lower-wage workers who can't afford a family dinner on this National Day of Thanks. Yes, this corporate colossus with an annual income greater than 140 countries wants its poorly paid employees to buy food for fellow employees whose paychecks leave them in deep poverty. More astonishing is the corporation's insipid, self-congratulatory insistence that the employee food drive demonstrates its deep ethical commitment to the welfare of all Walmart associates, as it grandiosely calls its beleaguered workers. The spokesman for the giant asserted that, quote, "This is part of the company's culture to rally around associates and take care of them." But of course, the company is not taking care of them at all. It won't pay a living wage, won't provide decent health care or other needed benefits, won't allow workers to organize so they can have their own voice, and then it abandons them to beg for scraps if they want to share in Thanksgiving with other Americans. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is obscene, a moral outrage. Three Waltons, Alice, Robson, and Jim, are heirs to the Walmart fortune and are sitting on more than $33 billion apiece, profiting on the low wages the corporation pays. Oughtn't they at least pony up a pittance from their prodigious inheritance for a few turkey and sweet potato dinners on Thanksgiving? To push for a modicum of fairness, contact www.farrespect.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
When the blew the horn, and the wall came down. They'd all been won. When the wall came down, I'll sit down on the Russians. There ain't no union, just corporate criminals.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, Larry Pratt, I'm sure you know the name, the Gun Owners of America executive director. He was speaking to one of the 9-12 groups. I'm surprised they're still around, but he was speaking to one of the 9-12 groups saying that he's found in the Bible that, find guns in the Bible, and that, it's proof that God was judging unarmed Americans and blessing gun owners. Okay. And under the heading of more fun with guns, I look at Mississippi. Yes, the good state of Mississippi, where a gentleman decided he was going to go to church. Nice Sunday. Got his best gun. Decided to take his loaded 9mm handgun to church with him. As the congregation was sitting down, Joseph Edgar Ray sat down. The gun went off in his pocket. Now, the hope is that, you go, okay, well, hopefully the story goes that he can't go forth and be fruitful. No more multiplying, but that wasn't the case. The firearm discharged. Bullet lodged in the concrete floor. The shrapnel, the shell hit a woman next to him. He's going to be charged, I guess, which I find interesting. He's going to be charged with, discharging a firearm within the city limits. And I'm sure it'll come with I'll make sure you don't do it again. What I found interesting, though, now understand, Mississippi is an open carry state, which means you can carry a gun anywhere you want. They do have concealed permits. And in fact, they have something called an enhanced carry permit, that allows people to ignore signs. like the sign in the church that said it's prohibited to carry a pistol or a revolver on the church campus. It's against the, it's prohibited. We don't want you on our private property with a gun. You can make the choice not to come on the private property, but evidently these enhanced carry permits, which I would assume would be huge obstacles to get one of these enhanced carry permits. You know, like actually understanding how to put the safety on before you put the gun in your pocket. Maybe, you know, putting in a holster, stuff, you know, stuff like that in the enhanced part. Now, we're talking about Mississippi, so, you know, that might be a reach. I guess not. And the police chief says he's not going to release the photograph of the mugshot of the guy who did it. And I'm sure he's very sorry. You know, he's an upstanding guy, as the report says. So he's not going to release the mugshot. He says, the police chief says, the whole thing we're trying to get people to understand, we're an open carry state and we have the carry permit for concealed. If you're going to carry one, you need to be responsible. Yes, yes, I agree. He says, you know, practice good gun safety. Make sure it's in a holster and stuff like that. Because once the bullet leaves the barrel, you can't bring it back. Yeah, I agree. Maybe if we thought like that more often, maybe the gun wouldn't have gone off in the first place. Or maybe you just left it at home. After all, you're going to church. Just a thought. Anyway, interesting news. Philadelphia has become the very first city in the country. Yes, the very first city in the country to ban people from manufacturing guns with 3D printers. And I got to be honest, I didn't know that was a problem yet. But the way the article lays it out is it's quite possible that for very very cheaply, somewhere in the $1,500 to $8,000 range, you could print off a gun. And they're saying that, you know, the technology is going to eventually trickle down to consumers, and you're going to be able to, you know, purchase these plastic printers at cheap prices. And, you know, they've already got 3D printers that manufacture bullets and metal guns. You know, what's next? So the city of Philadelphia has said no. Now, it's interesting the NRA hasn't really said anything yet, because here's the interesting part of this. You know, they're pro-gun, but they're also pro-gun manufacturer. If we give people the ability to manufacture guns in their own home, then where does the NRA stand? Because there's no real profit in it then. It's quite a quandary if you think about it. You know, because the NRA gets most of their money from the manufacturers, or a good portion of their money from the manufacturers of guns, as well as some membership dues. But most of the money comes from the gun manufacturers. So you got to look at this and go, you know, where are you going to go with this? You got to stand up for your guns, right? Nothing, no infringement on my right to make and own and bear a gun, right? Because I'm certain that the new reading of the Constitution will be the right to make arms as well as bear them. And that militia part gone. Just, it won't happen. So there you go. Another interesting story. George Zimmerman back in the news. Evidently he was being sought after for I guess assault, some kind of domestic abuse kind of thing, with the new girlfriend. Aggravated assault and battery, I guess. And I had this thought, you know, as the police released the news on Monday that they came up with that Zimmerman had a rifle, three handguns, 106 rounds of ammunition, magazines for an AR-15 assault rifle, pocket knives, 12-gauge shotguns, all of this armament. And you gotta go, who was the real thug in all of this? Because, you know, I didn't, you know, up until Trayvon Martin, I didn't hear that name very often. Now I'm hearing this guy's name almost every other week. It's kind of, well, kind of shows that, you know, I go, you know, who's the thug in this? And maybe, I don't know. And finally, in the fun with guns segment, a Nashville bar owner shot and killed a country music singer. Not because he was singing country music, and which then I would understand. That's not right. But because he was smoking in the bar, and he doesn't like smoking in the bar. What I find interesting is in 2010, the state of Tennessee, both the House and the Senate overrode the veto of the Democratic governor that would stop people from carrying guns in bars. Nope, the Republicans in the state of Tennessee said, no, we want our guns in bars. And, well, here you go. The country, we will never know the musical stylings of country singer Gerald Wayne Mills, who was the one who was smoking at 5 o'clock in the morning and shot dead by the bar owner, who they said was his friend. I mean, so I'm going, well, okay. Now, the friend, Chris Farrell, says, it was self-defense. I was standing my ground. So there you go. More fun with guns. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll be back here tomorrow. See you then.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together.